Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
I could be weak. I could be sad. You know I could be. Thanks, you guys are awesome. You guys are wicked, and I'm rules. We'll be back. We'll see you in the merch booth.
Splendiferous. 3 Days Grace closing it down with I Hate Everything About You. But you know that's not the way we feel about you here on High Voltage most of the time. They, along with Saving Abel, were recorded by Westwood One Mobile. Biff Dawes, engineer, assisted by Doug Field, Phil Kneebone, and Jay Resnick. This program is written and reduced by Fred Lindgren. In studio production by Stephen Cosio. Executive pimp practitioner, Norm Pattis. Hey, you got any questions, comments, suggestions, or you'd like to make a donation to our bailout fund? Email us at ww1highvoltage@gmail.com. All right? Don't be sending me any spam or viruses. Until next time, peace out, bitches.
101.1 WRIF. WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now.
They cannot take pride. Pride.
Yeah, the revolution starts now in your own backyard, in your own hometown. What you do is spin around your body and heart. The revolution starts now.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call. The Riff's Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast, Jalene Jordan. We missed you last week.
I know, I missed you too, but glad to be back.
I was trying to sing... I don't think I got more than a few bars out of I've Grown Accustomed to Your Face.
From your wife told you to never sing on this show.
I know. From My Fair Lady.
That's very sweet.
Yeah.
But it's good to be back. A lot has been happening this past week.
I guess. When is it going to be a pitchfork moment? You know, when the peasants come out into the town square with our pitchforks and say, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. I mean, people grumble about that to one another. I talk to people that are so angry, people not in auto, that I talked to one guy in the park where we take our dog, and he said he couldn't sleep the night that bailout for the automobile companies, the bridge loan, not even a bailout. They're going to pay it back. What else? Who else was I talking to that just people are just beside themselves? We should be.
And some things are happening. There was that Chicago and factory and factory in Chicago where there was a sit-in, and so on small levels, but it does really need to be on a much larger level.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little later, too. Right now, the Bush administration's got no lifeline planned for the, look at it, it says here, the teetering auto industry. This was the bedrock of American industrialism.
Call it teetering? Isn't it more like spiraling?
Downward. And the Republicans, of course, blocked this $14 billion in loans. And right now, Bush has absolutely no clout whatsoever. But he went on this unannounced trip to Iraq. And someone might ask, why in the hell was his butt over there trying to, you know, for all these photo ops, which we will talk about in just a second? It didn't work out. The photo ops didn't work out too well for him. In fact, why don't we go to that first? I think anybody who's been watching the news this evening knows that an Iraqi journalist hurled his shoes and an insult at George Bush, missed him as he was standing at the podium in Baghdad, shaking hands with the Iraqi premier at his Baghdad office on Sunday. And the two leaders met in Nouri al-Maliki's private office, and a journalist who was sitting in the third row suddenly jumped up, shouted, printer. This is a gift from the Iraqis. This is the farewell kiss, you dog. He then threw a shoe at Bush, who ducked and narrowly avoided it. And you saw the
video.
Yeah.
If you just go online, you can see the video. And I have to say, the guy's got some quick reflexes.
Bush.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He, I mean, it was one shoe at a time,
yeah.
And he just boom down and then back up and then boom down again. I was amazed.
And he laughed it off.
I think he spit. He laughed it off and said, "I think that was a size 10."
You're right. Said he didn't feel the least bit threatened by it. And what he played it down and said, "I don't know what the guy's cause is."
What do you think?
Yeah. Now, one of the things that hasn't been reported virtually anywhere is when he threw the first shoe at George W. Bush. He said, "This is a gift from the Iraqis. This is the farewell kiss, you dog." And as much as you and I, Jolene, love our doggies.
We do.
We do. And so many Americans do. They're not held in high regard.
That's true.
In Iraq. So calling someone a dog is...
Well, yeah, and the shoe thing.
The shoe thing.
I mean, if you throw your shoes or hit someone with your shoes or show the soles of your shoes to someone, that is a sign of disrespect.
Yes.
So
great insult.
Yeah, so
great
it's the insult from their point of view, and that's exactly what they did, rather than, you know, what a lot of people, I would be concerned for my life over there if I were George Bush.
Sure. As stunned security agents and guards, officials and journalists watched, let me see, I have the name here, Muntadhar al-Zaidi, 28, a correspondent for Al-Baghdadiya. It's an independent Iraqi television station. He was about 12 feet from Bush, and he shouted in Arabic, "This is a gift from the Iraqis. This is a farewell kiss, you dog." He then threw a shoe at Bush, who ducked and narrowly avoided it. And then he yelled, he threw his other shoe, and shouting in Arabic, "This is from..." Wait, let's pair this up correctly. Bush says, "I don't know what the guy's cause is." He says, "You know, that's what people do in a free society, draw attention to themselves." As the man screaming could be heard outside because they were kicking the living daylights out of him. Maliki's security agents jumped on the man, wrestled him to the floor, and hustled him out of the room. They kicked and beat him till he was crying like a woman, said a reporter for Afaq.
Okay, and I resent that as well. Thank you.
Yeah, but here, this is the important part of it. Bush says, "I don't know what the guy's cause is." Here's what preceded the throwing of the second shoe. A shoe. "This is from the widows, the orphans, and those who were killed in Iraq." Now, this is what it's all about. Bush is over there. Where is that other piece? Oh, yeah. Iraq war is not over. More work ahead. Now, the prevailing wisdom, if you will, in the media, which, of course, ebbs and flows with politician seems to have the edge at a particular time. First and foremost, this was never a war, as so many people have reminded us. And for precision's sake, we ought to realize that it was an occupation. It was an invasion and an occupation. It never was a war because we were never fighting another army. We were fighting the people of Iraq who did not want a foreign invasion and occupation. As much as most Iraqis hated Saddam Hussein, they were not pleased to have a foreign Western army come 6,000 miles from their home, our home, and begin destroying the nation. And besides the fact that Bush should have been here working on the economy, I mean, what a joke, right? But at least trying to work up the basis for a short-term bridge loan, there are hundreds of thousands of Iraqis that have been killed or wounded by U.S. forces, and in the internecine, the communal fighting. One of the reasons that there's so little violence left there is there's been enormous ethnic cleansing. The people that were fighting have been forced out of one area or another, or you and I, dear friends, in this time of tenuous economic circumstances, have been paying hundreds of millions of dollars to Sunni insurgents who figured, wait a minute, these guys from Michigan and Texas and New Jersey and Wyoming, they're really kicking our butt. And, you know, they're destroying our infrastructure. They're killing our people by the thousands. Let's get paid by them instead. Doesn't that make a lot of sense? So economically. So they essentially, talking about precision, we have bought off the Sunni insurgency. Was there Al-Qaeda there? Remember those people that were like lopping off heads and what have you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're pretty awful folks, and they did come from all around the world. That's what brought terrorists to Iraq.
That's right.
Yeah, the fact that the United States was there. This was the arena of jihad that was provided for them by us and our treasury, the lives and the limbs of our soldiers. Now totaling, remember that? You know, remember people we talk about all the time? There's 4,200. I don't even know now how many Americans have lost their lives.
It's between 5,000 and 6,000.
No, yeah. I think it's still below 4,500. But there's 30,000 to 35,000 severely wounded Americans, all sorts of American soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorder.
It's a mess from beginning to end.
Yeah,
and it will end.
And all based on a lie.
Yeah, exactly. And we can't mention that too much. I really believe that.
There's an unpublished 513-page federal history of the American-led reconstruction of Iraq. That's one of the things that we spend our money, yours and mine, is that we destroy something, then we rebuild it. So we destroyed the country, destroyed its infrastructure, and then put up about $100 billion to rebuild it. And, of course, it all went to, like, Vice President Cheney. Remember that guy? Who, by the way, is for the bailout.
Really?
Yeah, yes. But in any event, this American-led reconstruction of Iraq, this report depicts an effort crippled before the invasion by Pentagon planners who are hostile to the idea of rebuilding a foreign country, then molded into a $100 billion failure by bureaucratic turf wars, spiraling violence, and ignorance of the basic elements of Iraqi society and infrastructure. So that's $100 billion of our tax dollars. Now, what are our auto companies asking for? $14 billion.
Right. And they're squawking over that.
Yeah. Now, I always say that when you talk about money being lost, it's not like it got lost in the wash. You know, you put a $20 bill in there and it just, like, disintegrated in your pocket or something like that because you forgot to take it out of your jeans. But it always winds up in the hands of somebody. It actually did. The United States, was sending our money oftentimes in these huge cargo ships in these skids. So they would have, like, millions and millions of dollars, and this would be passed out to buy favors, to pay people off, to pay people, on and on. And so the history, the first official account of its kind, is circulating in draft form in Washington among a tight circle of technical reviewers, policy experts, and senior officials, and just goes on and on and on. Another report that has come out that ought to... mean that that Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and the rest of them are frog marched out of their offices to The Hague, to the World Court, because this report, this is a bipartisan Senate report. That means it was Republicans and Democrats. The physical and mental abuse of detainees, commonly called torture, but of course the Associated Press is a little too polite to call it that. The physical and mental abuse of detainees in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, was the direct result of Bush administration detention policies and should not be dismissed as the work of bad guards or interrogators, according to this. Now, I don't want to let in the headlines, this panel blames White House, not soldiers, for abuse. Well, somebody was administering the torture, and dozens of prisoners have died in U.S. custody.
So
the idea that that you can't blame individuals because they were just following orders just doesn't wash. So that's what Bush is up to. He is over in Iraq trying to
he's distracting from the bailout he always does. So whatever the hot button issue is, he's off to something that, you know.
All right. I don't even think I gave the basics, did I, Jalene? Peter Werby with you. Jalene Jordan here as well. Our phone numbers are 313-298-WRIF.
It's 313-298-9743.
For your comments, we'll get you on the air. CallTalkYes@Yahoo.com. That's CallTalkYes@Yahoo.com. Short remarks, please. We'll read some of them. That's for the bashful and when the lines are filled, which they are not right now. So, with Bush over in Iraq getting shoes thrown at him by an irate Iraqi journalist, he's not here trying to create a deal on these auto loans. Now, increasingly, and particularly among the right wing, what appears to be at the center of this dispute over the bailout of the bridge loans is the United Auto Workers and the wage structure that they have, and supposedly the unwillingness of Ron Gettelfinger to compromise. Well, he has bent over and given up so much over the last few years, it is just absolutely amazing. Let me see, where, as it is this a UAW statement? I think so. Unfortunately, Senate Republicans insisted this had to be accomplished by an arbitrary deadline. Oh, this was to, let's see, they had to work out a program that would create parity with the foreign auto firms that are non-union, that are that do production in the United States. And it said, this arbitrary requirement was not imposed on any other stakeholder group. Stakeholder means what kind of who has a stake in this? Who has a stake in this? Thus, the UAW believed this was a blatant attempt to make workers shoulder the lion's share of the cost of any restructuring effort. Last year, the UAW agreed to sharply lower starting wages and benefits for new hires as little as $14 an hour. And I don't know what more of a compromise that you could imagine. I mean, this is a compromise, a give back, a massive defeat for industrial workers that three generations fought for to bring workers into the middle class, the people that labor at the most dangerous and dirty and routinized job, who should be rewarded grandly. And who screwed up? Not the workers. I mean, who signed these contracts? It wasn't the workers. But all of it is just BS anyways. Here, this is from Robert Weissman, who's an editor in Washington, D.C., of the Multinational Monitor. And he says, auto worker compensation makes up a small cost of manufacturing a car, less than 10%. Somebody's made the point, if UAW workers agreed to work for free, that it wouldn't affect the problem that the auto industry has at all. It's not that big a factor. Weissman says you can slash wages as much as you want, but you won't bring costs down by much. By contrast, as you would expect in a service industry, compensation makes up a huge portion of costs for the financial sector. The New York State Comptroller lists employee compensation costs as equivalent to more than 60% of the 2000 revenue for the seven largest financial firms headquartered in New York City. But did anyone ask these workers in the financial firms to take a cut in their wages? I'm not talking about the big CEOs. I'm talking about just the ordinary workers.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah. Let's see. In 2007, average wage and benefit costs per employee at Goldman Sachs, remember they got this enormous bailout with no conditions hardly at all, per average employee, $661,000 for each worker. $150,000 a year for a UAW worker. Congress has allocated $700 billion to bail out Wall Street, but the overall total is higher by an order of magnitude, including all the loans, investments, swaps, guarantees, and more. The federal government has doled out more than $7 trillion to Wall Street.
Ugh.
And I don't know.
And we want 14. They want 14 billion.
I don't know how to really put that, but 14 billion is when put up against 7 trillion. It's kind of like what you have in your pocket. It's
right.
kind of pocket
change. Like the change in the bottom of my purse.
Exactly. Let's see what else is in here. So don't buy this stuff about the UAW wages. There's two aspects of that. One is just the overall drive by business that is represented 100% by the Republicans. I mean, the Democrats got a lot of corporate interests too, but that's all the Republicans are all about. And then they're just able to fool any number of people that somehow they have America's interests.
Oh, they've been doing that, especially, I mean, for a long time, since 2001. It's been ugly.
Yeah, they want to peasantize us. They want us to thatch our roofs, and they don't want us to have pitchforks. They don't want us to have any pitchfork moments, so that's how they can fool us. So we just get angry, and we just kind of sit in our little thatched roof huts and grumble, or if we see somebody at the gas pump when gas was over $4 a gallon, we say, isn't this terrible? This is terrible. Really terrible. Like that. On one hand, it is an attack particularly the industrial middle class, but it's an attack on all of our wage standards other than the elite. So they figure if they can break the wage structure of unionized employees, what can they do to you and me? And if any of you are saying, I get it, they're all overpaid, and I hope they get, I hope their union goes to hell, and I hope blah, 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 stuff like that, they're after you next. If they can do this to the almighty UAW, What do you think they're going to do to you, the solitary, non-organized, non-unionized, at-will employee?
Mm.
Because when UAW workers and Ron Gettelfinger out of rotten hell forever putting this up, $14 an hour, which is like half pay for what industrial workers in auto were making, what is that going to mean for you? Yeah, you. Where was I just seeing? Oh, some. Well, actually, I got that somewhere else. Never mind. Now, the other part of it is this attack on the Democratic Party. The reason that Barack Obama is about to be inaugurated President of the United States on January 20th is because of the UAW and AFSCME and all Teamsters and all the rest of the unions. In 2004, John Kerry in Ohio, which, I mean, the Bush machine had to steal Ohio from him even to win, so that shows, you know, how close it was. That they had, I forgot what it was, either 7 or 8 county offices in Ohio, all in urban areas. So Cleveland, Dayton, Toledo,
right.
Akron, places like this. This time around, because of the unions, they had an office in every one of the 82 counties.
Really?
Yeah. So they had, instead of 7 offices, they had 82 offices.
Whoa.
And these were staffed in the main by union people. People, the UAW headquarters in Detroit sent, people I know were sent to Ohio for weeks at a time to do organizing because they knew, how critical this was. So what this is all about, and people talk about this, Shelby. Richard Shelby?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Dick Shelby is
one of the Republicans who is against it.
Who everybody says, oh, he's doing it because he's got these non-union foreign plants in Alabama, where he's from and all that. I mean, he's a multimillionaire, one of the richest men in the Senate. He's got all these scams, favoritism and concessions.
Well, they're protecting did you already say this? Protecting the foreign interests, the foreign automakers.
Except
the foreign automakers are against what they're doing. They want the bailout. They're for it because they know it's good for the auto industry as a whole. And they have
the foreign car makers.
Yeah, the foreign car makers.
So it's not about UAW wages. It's not about foreign car makers in the South. What they want is they want to destroy the UAW. They want to destroy one of the bulwarks of the Democratic Party. These people are so crass. I mean, here they're always saying, you know, we're America's party. These people are the slimiest, dirtiest, nihilistic. Nihilistic, you know that? Just destroy everything. You know, either we rule or everything is destroyed. I mean, that's what it's all about. That's absolutely what it's all about. Hey, did any of you, there's an ex-Tiger pitcher, Jim Bunning, who was this incredible guy. He was first pitcher to win 100 games and throw 1,000 strikeouts in both leagues. He actually hit more opposing hitters than nearly anybody in the major league history. He's in the Baseball Hall of Fame, but he's also this ding-a-ling guy, and he's won a second term as a senator from Kentucky. Now, he has been he voted to kill the rescue package for Detroit auto companies, and he came to Michigan. He was here on Sunday to hawk his autograph to us Michiganders at $55 a pop.
Oh, yeah, $55 for jerseys or gloves, posters $45, baseballs $35. He was out at Gibraltar there in Taylor.
Anybody go out there? Because there was some talk of people were going to go out there and meet him. Anybody either go out there directly or, I don't know if this was covered on the news, but Jim Bunning is, I mean, how crass. Let's see. I mean, what could he make? Autographs, $35 a piece and all that. I mean, say he could make $2,000.
Yeah, 3,000. I don't know. I don't know how much people, you know, but he's no Detroiter. That's what all I have to say. He's no Michigander.
Yeah. So.
Boo.
Yeah. How quickly can we get rid of these guys? And is Bush back? There he was. He's, ducking shoes. All right. Let's real quickly get a couple calls on, and then we'll. Well, let's do that. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Mike in Birmingham. Mike, hi. Welcome to the broadcast.
How you doing, Peter?
Good.
I've got one thing to say about that boot throwing incident at the President of the United States. Too bad he missed.
Well, he wouldn't have been hurt.
You said
much.
It.
Yeah.
he would have been hurt anyway.
Yeah, you get getting hit by a shoe from 12 feet. Actually, Dana Perino, her dimness, had her eye injured. A mic fell on her or something like that in this big squabble.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
All right, thank you for that. Here's Sharon in Shelby Township. Hi, Peter. You're with Peter and Jalene on WRIF. Welcome.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Good.
Good.
I have two things for you. That thing at Gibraltar?
Yeah. Yeah.
The owner or the manager of Gibraltar canceled him.
Oh,
really?
He said he wouldn't bring him in because he thought that what he did in the Senate was way off.
Okay.
Good to know.
He canceled. It was in the newspaper today.
Oh, I missed that.
Peter, yeah. I read the newspaper today. Where was it?
Probably not the sports section.
Yeah. I see
That's
a couple
where
of,
it was.
Oh, yeah. Neither of us read that.
Yeah, that was in the sports section.
Sharon, that should have been on the front page.
Yeah.
It should have been, but it wasn't a sport. It wasn't a sport.
That explains it.
So the second thing is, I love that Bush video. The first time I saw it, I laughed so hard I cried.
I know.
He was ducking like he always has stuff thrown at him.
Well, it really was. That's what I was kind of trying to allude to earlier, is that he has experience in ducking. Or he's been in front of the mirror at the White House practicing.
Yes, I laughed so hard, and then he ducked the second one. How they got the second one off without the Secret Service being all over it, I don't know.
Yeah. Good point.
And they really, I mean, here, Democratic Iraq, our ally and all that, and the Iraqi security just beat the living hell out of them. Now, you know, somebody like that obviously is going to be apprehended, should be restrained, but they were really into doing a number on them.
See, I never heard that part. I just saw that video, and I laughed so hard the first time I cried.
Yeah. You know, actually, I noticed that because the guy just sort of disappeared, and you could tell that he was being he was on the ground. He was being kicked repeatedly, and apparently, I read it earlier on the air, they said that they had beat him till he cried like a baby.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, it is. All right. Well, thank you for the information. Senator Jim Bunning of Kentucky, who voted against the bailout for the auto companies, the ex-Tiger pitcher, was going to come here and charge $55 for signing stuff. He got canceled out. How sweet it is.
Yes.
All right. We're going to take another call right here. It's Alicia from Waterford. Alicia, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
I just want to say that I agree with everything Janice said about Bush just trying to distract us from, like, you know, what he said a couple days ago about, you know, trying to help the auto industry.
Yeah.
I agree with it 100%. And my father, he actually, he retired just this last June. He retired just in time before all this stuff happened.
Wow.
What does he have to say about it?
Well, he's just glad that he got out of there while he could. But the thing is, right now is with the bailout, like, you know, we could lose his retirement pension.
Well, I mean, if it goes down, and that's what that's another thing that they're trying to do. I mean, one of the reasons that the costs to the auto companies is so high is because, and when you hear that stuff about auto workers making $73 an hour, they factor in the commitment that has been made to the people that are on pensions. Geez, I mean, you work 30 years in an auto plant, and then people are complaining that you're getting health care. I mean, that is just horrible.
Yeah, and he has 30 years in.
Wow.
Yeah, and another thing, I would like to just commend you for commenting on the war, that what's going on in Iraq was not a war. It was an invasion and a, you know what I mean?
Occupation. Yeah, but it wasn't a war. Yeah, who are we fighting? I mean, we don't ever hear about that. Yeah.
You guys are, like, the first people, like, you know, to, like, I've actually heard that from who actually feels the same way I do about it. Like, this is not a war. This is an occupation.
Well, you don't get that on the mainstream media. That's what's such a problem.
They try and, like, you know, cover it up or sugarcoat it or go way too extreme.
You got it. All right, Alicia, thank you very much. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. A short break, open lines for you. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, we'll be right back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. Trans-Siberian
Orchestra. Two great shows, matinee and evening, December 21st at the Palace of Auburn Hills. Keep it here to win your free tickets for TSL from your concert station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing, and we want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new MKS, the MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. You can check out our vehicle inventory on the site, and you can bet that if you don't see what you're looking for, we can surely find it for you. Experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood in Dearborn. Give us a call today. 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com. That's DEMMER.com.
Experience the Demmer difference. Right now at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury, lease a 2009 Lincoln MKS for $379 a month. Based on an AZ plan with Ford Lincoln Mercury lease renewal and $1,969 down plus tax. See dealer for details or check them out on the web at Demmer.com.
You don't need to wait until December 25th to celebrate, because December 17th is Christmas at Trump's. Trump's Christmas party is one that you don't want to miss.
More than 100 women will be working. Plus, there will be prizes, gifts, a complimentary buffet, shrimp, lobster tail, and prime rib, and an ice luge and drink specials nonstop.
A free buffet, 100 girls, prizes, drink specials. That is Christmas come early at Trump's.
Mark it on your calendar. Trump's Christmas party is all day and night, December 17th. Trump's on 8 Mile, where the presents unwrap themselves.
What's a Wall-U?
It's the perfect gift for the holidays.
But what is a Wall-U?
Your kid will love it.
So what is a Wall-U?
Wall-U is a life-size vinyl graphic that sticks to any surface. So, you know, you can show off your little leaguer just like the pros. It looks great in the bedroom, basement, garage, or anywhere you want to decorate. And it's not just for kids. Get a Wall-U of your motorcycle or your sports car or boat. For anything you want to show off, it's a Wall-U. So check it out now at www.wall-theletteru.com. That's wall-theletteru.com. Wall-U, the perfect gift.
What's a Wall-U?
It's the perfect gift for the holidays.
But what is a Wall-U?
Your kid will love it.
So what is a Wall-U?
All right, we've been over this before, but it does bear repeating. A Wall-U is a life-size vinyl graphic that sticks to any surface. Imagine the possibilities. Whatever you have that you want to show off, it's a Wall-U. Look for the Wall-U ad on WRIF.com.
Is your credit score holding you back? Are you paying more for everything just because you don't have perfect credit? Well, it's not your fault. Credit card companies are doing everything they can to keep you in debt and never let you escape. But I've got a system that can fix your credit score once and for all. And I'm going to send you a free tape showing you the power of my proven system today.
My credit score is now 758. My wife and I are shouting for joy right now.
Hi, I'm John Commuta, creator of the Transforming Debt into Wealth system. My system doesn't just fix your credit score, it will permanently rebuild your credit status so it can never come back to haunt you again. It works no matter how bad your credit is or how much debt you have.
Our credit score was in the low 600s and now we're at 780.
You can wipe the slate clean once and for all. Call right now and I'll rush you my free tape. For your free tape, call 1-800-337-1713. That's 1-800-337-1713. 1-800-337-1713.
Between the millions of millionaires in this country and you? Simple. They decided they wanted to be millionaires, so they went out and did it. So, do you want to be a millionaire? If the answer is yes, then get ready to write down a number that could change your life forever. Because now you can get a free CD that shows you everything you need to start making the kind of money you deserve with an internet business that virtually runs itself. So you're making cash even while you're sleeping by selling products you don't have to see, store, or even pay for. There are millions of millionaires out there. Don't you want to be one of them? Get the free CD from Internet Speedway and start making money with an internet business that virtually runs itself. For your free CD, call 1-800-339-1419. Deciding to be wealthy is the first step to becoming wealthy. Call now, 1-800-339-1419. The free CD is yours by calling 1-800-339-1419.
If the IRS tells you that you still owe back taxes, what can you do? Or if the state tax collector threatens you with wage garnishments, penalties, or seizures, what are your options? As an honest, hard-working American, you do have rights. If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Just call 800-493-8159. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debts for less than you owe, remove penalties and interest, and get the collector off your case. Don't let your tax problem get worse. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save. Call 800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 800-493-8159. That's 800-493-8159.
Here again, the 12 days of Riffmas are back. You're hooked up for the holidays with a Riff Big Old Bag of Cheer. Tickets galore, including seats in rows 12 through 1 for Trans-Siberian Orchestra, December 21st, Gifts for Her, from East Diamond Jewelers, Lover's Lane, digital music downloads, and more. Just listen for Santa Poobah to wish you happy holidays for your chance to win. It's the 12 days of Riffmas.
Listen and win.
From 101-WRIF, everything that rocks.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Julian Jordan is with me. You can reach us at 313-298-WRIF. As you can imagine, in part, we're talking about the bailout. Also, George W. Bush getting shoes thrown at him by an irate Iraqi journalist at a press conference. What in the hell is George Bush doing in Baghdad and not in Washington working on a bailout?
Exactly.
Yeah.
We got an email from Jeff in Canton who says, for what the Republicans in Washington are pulling on the big three, should be a screaming example of why blue-collar workers should never vote Republican. Why so many of them do, I can't understand.
Yeah. About a third did. So it's not that bad. But
don't do it again.
Here, according to the Zogby poll, this is, I don't know what to make of this. Surprisingly, says the poll, 57.5% of self-declared union members think Congress should deny the big three a taxpayer-funded bailout, while only 30% of union members approve of such a bailout. 13% are not sure. Overall, 61% of American voters are opposed to a bailout for the automakers. Could this be? It doesn't sound, do they realize it's not just about, some UAW workers? This is all of us. I mean, we have.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, the depression of the 30s began with a stock market collapse. That's like the first phase. And then there's a spiraling downward of business activities, mm-hmm. layoffs, which cause other businesses to go, to be ruined, which then they lay off employees. And I'm worried. I mean, some of the sincere critics, which does not include any of the Republicans, the sincere critics of the bailout that say this isn't going to work, I mean, I'm fearful that they may have something of an argument. I don't know. I don't know one way or the other. That's what is particularly frightening. Nobody really knows any of this for sure.
Yeah.
But I would rather err on the side of
the people.
Yeah, and at least trying, because what is their deal? A bailout? A bankruptcy? This is what ex-Governor Romney of Massachusetts said, and he's still saying it. I saw him on Meet the Press with Governor Granholm, and he was saying there's got to be this managed bankruptcy. Now, I don't know about you, but as so many people have said, who would buy a car from a firm in bankruptcy? I'll tell you, for a while, and now this is what's happening. We're not, but my wife and I were looking at buying a new car. The guy that works on this American car we have, which I'm sorry to say, has just been an absolute disaster in terms of the thousands of dollars we've had to spend on repairs for it. He said, you're crazy if you don't buy a Toyota or a Honda.
Wow.
And my heart sort of sunk when I heard that, you know. Mm-hmm. And yet, here's a guy that's been taking thousands of dollars of my money who says,
"You're crazy."
Yeah, if you want to, if you don't want to stop paying me so much, get a foreign, non-union car. So we're not getting one at all. But if you buy one of the big three, you can get a free cup of coffee.
Oh, yes, AJ's Cafe in Ferndale.
Right, on 9 Mile Road in fabulous Ferndale. Let's see here. There's an I Promise campaign at AJ's Music Cafe. It's at 240 West 9 Mile Road.
It's a great place. I hang out there.
Yeah, it's Wi-Fi. Well, I guess they all are now, aren't they?
Well, not all, and it is. And I'll take the laptop down there and chill out. They have nice things. And it's a locally owned business.
Yeah. Now, this, listen, folks, we're at one of these points in history. We're living through it, and we have a lot of feelings about it, but it's hard to really realize if there's still history being written in 20 or 30 years, this is going to be like a point that is going to be significant. You know, like the 1960s or the 1950s and the Civil Rights Movement or the 1930s and what happened then. This is going to be a similar period we're living through. And one of the things that marked, as you noticed, the 1960s, the 1950s, and the 1930s was that they were all pitchfork moments that people took their lives and said, we are going to define them. The elites have crashed and trashed our lives. The guys in the suits, the wealthy guys, all those folks, they have just essentially screwed up everything, haven't they? And so it's time for us to take charge.
Take charge.
And here's an idea. Bad guys have screwed up everything, haven't they? Well, here's some things that I would say would be good not to do. Do not do this. You will not enter the stage of history as an actor by doing these things. Well, in a way, you will. I mean, if you do anything other than just passively observe, you are beginning to be what they call a subject in history and not an object. That is, right now, we're just all being moved around. We are hoping that everything just doesn't go completely to hell. We are hoping that Bush can somehow get through $14 billion in a short-term bridge loan. We're hoping that Barack Obama will create a whole different set of circumstances here. Hope will not do it. It is a thin reed, and that means we are passively hoping. What was I saying last? Oh, you weren't here. I was saying last week. Hope is like, you hope it doesn't rain because you're having a picnic, right? Or you hope that the results aren't bad for some medical test, but it's something you've given up completely in terms of you having an effect. Well, today, police are looking for a man they say vandalized five foreign cars in a Woodhaven store parking lot. This is what not to do. He punctured both passenger side tires on a Toyota, a Volkswagen, a Honda, a Mazda, and a Hyundai?
Hyundai.
Hyundai. Okay.
Yes.
And wrote, "Buy USA" on each car in magic marker. Had between 3 and 6 outside the Lowe's and Kohl's store in Woodhaven. The suspect is a white man who drives a red Ford Escape and appears to be middle-aged. But that's not what to do. Here's really what not to do. This is an absolute don't do this. A man has been charged with first-degree murder after a shooting at an office party, a Christmas party in Vancouver. Police allege Eric Kirkpatrick, 61, another one of these middle-aged guys who are that old, opened fire at the Tall Grass Distribution Limited Christmas party, killing Benjamin Banky, 40. Banky was the CEO of Tall Grass Distribution. So definitely not to do that as well. That is not a way to deal with what we can be dealt.
Dealt.
What could I have been thinking? Yeah.
You're thinking cars.
Yeah. Here's what else not to do. Mentioned this last week. The Sunday service at the Greater Grace Temple in Detroit began with the Clark Sisters song, "I'm Looking for a Miracle," and included a reading of a verse from the book of Romans that I consider the present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. There were SUVs on stage at the Sunday service at the Greater Grace
Temple. I saw that.
A Chevrolet Tahoe, a Ford Escape, and a Chrysler Aspen on loan from local dealerships were all gas electric hybrids. And General Holefeld, a UAW vice president for Chrysler, told the crowd, "We have done all that we can do in this union, so I turn it over to the Lord."
You cannot petition the Lord with prayer!
Thank you, Jim Morrison. Well, yeah, and there's an article from the New York Times today. Bad times draw bigger crowds to churches. Now, in the 1930s and as well as in the 1890s, churches, in some cases, played a very significant and important role for social justice. So churches that are doing that, those are cool. But if they're just sitting around, one more time, remember, yep, wrong one.
No, you have to re-cue it up there.
Oh, well, never mind.
We can't, tried.
Yeah, we can't let Jim Morrison get another go. It doesn't matter. Bad times are good. Bad times are good for evangelical churches. All right, so all of that doesn't work. But here's what does work. And that was the Republic Windows and Doors Chicago factory that was occupied by their workers who said, we are occupying this plant. We are not going out. And that,
how did that turn out?
They won.
They did.
Well, they all lost their jobs, but remember the company wasn't going to pay them their wages, right, their vacation pay.
I wonder if anyone out there who's working for the auto companies, would that be something that you would consider?
Well, the auto workers would never, ever do. Oh, no, that's right. That's how they started.
Yeah.
By occupying the Chevrolet plant in Flint.
A return to that. I don't know. Yeah. I'm not suggesting rioting or anything.
That's not what not to do. We don't need Greece, happening in Athens and over there. We need people to assemble and figure out what in the hell we're going to do. The elites have screwed it all up, so what are we going to do? That's what has to be addressed. All right, there's some open lines. You can help us figure it out. 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Here's Charlie in Ferndale. Charlie, thanks for your patience. I appreciate you waiting. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
We're doing good.
Hey, just listened to all your stuff, and I really appreciate your show, Peter.
Well, thank you.
I really agree. You spoke about so many things, the topics that are so awesome, about so many things that we need to take a big look at. One of them, the big three. I'm in the automotive industry myself. I've been laid off for a year and a month now.
Wow.
My gosh.
It's pretty bad, but, I'm still getting by with I'm exhausting my last emergency unemployment benefits. But that's just one thing. The second thing is what you guys were talking about, what Bush is doing. And sure enough, he is spending hand over fist, money after money, for things that we should have that money spent here.
Sure.
And we as the people, like you say, we should stand up and fight for what we believe in, because I think we've lost our faith somehow in the way we try to fight for things. I think we feel like we're all losers somehow.
Well, we've lost our faith in the government, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, that we should have. But here, we'll see. You were talking about how hopeful is this. A majority of Americans are expressing confidence in Barack Obama's ability to govern and unify the country, with many who didn't vote for him now seeing him as in a positive light. There was a poll, the Wall Street Journal, NBC, and the Wall Street Journal, the mouthpiece of big business, who is very anti-Democratic Party, their poll found that 73% of adults approve of the way he is handling the transition and his preparations for becoming president. They quote Kathleen Brizard, who is a 25-year-old massage therapist from Dallas. She voted for Republican Senator John McCain. I bet she's just probably a millionaire. That's why she voted.
Oh, yeah, right. She's got to protect all that dough.
But she says, so far, so good, said that the day after the election, she felt a sense of joy about Obama's victory that hasn't gone away. She says, and this is a Republican voter, I respect him, and we're all praying for the best. We definitely need a change, and he's definitely that change. So we'll see what happens, when.
I think a lot of people really believe that we have a big problem there.
Yeah.
And we as people of the United States are not really even sure whether it's Obama or McCain was either the right choice either way.
Well, I'll tell you, if Barack Obama cannot pull this out, and I'm sure McCain could. I mean, McCain and Palin would have been a disaster of a magnitude I don't even think we can appreciate. The worst case scenario, the apocalypse virtually coming down on it, I don't mean the religious one, but an economic one, is almost frightening to conceive of. So I know you cannot petition the Lord with prayer, but I guess those that are so inclined ought to give it a whirl. All right, Charlie, thank you very much. We're going to take a break. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
It's that time of year again. The 12 days of Riffmas are back.
You're hooked up for the holidays with a Riff Big Old Bag of Cheer.
Gifts galore.
Including seats in rows 12 through 1 for Trans-Siberian Orchestra, December 21st. Gifts for her from East Diamond Jewelers, Lover's Lane, digital music downloads, and more.
Just listen for Santa Poobah to wish you happy holidays for your chance to win. It's the 12 days of Riffmas.
Listen and win.
From 101 WRIF. Everything.
Do you know the fastest way to learn a new language?
Memorization?
We always did translation.
Is it drills?
The world's fastest, easiest way to learn a new language is Rosetta Stone software. It doesn't waste your time with tedious translation, useless memorization, or boring drills. Instead, it teaches you a new language the same way you learned your first language. And right now, you can experience it for yourself because Rosetta Stone is offering a free demo CD-ROM. Check out the easiest, fastest way to learn the language of your choice. For the free CD-ROM, call 1-800-441-6151. Discover what U.S. diplomats, NASA, and over 10,000 schools already know, that this is the world's fastest, easiest way to learn a language, guaranteed. Choose from 31 languages and request your free CD-ROM today. You'll be amazed at what you learn. Just call 1-800-441-6151. Request your free CD-ROM from Rosetta Stone by calling 1-800-441-6151. That's 1-800-441-6151.
In national news, the New York Mint is releasing to the public a limited number of $100 Union Silver coins. At the end of this broadcast, we'll provide a toll-free number you can call to receive free information and a free DVD. Sketches of the coin were recently discovered deep in the vaults of the Smithsonian. The $100 Union was proposed by George T. Morgan, who also designed the Morgan Silver Dollar. It was to be the largest coin ever in size and denomination, and it weighed in at a hefty 1.5 ounces. In a startling announcement, the New York Mint plans to release a limited quantity of $100 Union silver coins to the public. The silver $100 Union proofs are available on a first-come, first-serve basis by calling 1-800-957-5473. Please dial carefully. To receive the free collector's DVD containing the full story on this and many other coins, the number is 1-800-957-5473. That's 1-800-957-5473.
What exactly is telemetrics and what does it mean to me?
How does changing light bulbs save me money?
Where are the best places to find organically grown foods?
When will Michigan be seeing an increase in green building?
What are some easy steps my family can take to be more green?
How can my coworkers and I start a recycling program at work?
Got lots of questions on Michigan's green future? Get lots of answers at movingmichiganforward.com. You can also join the discussion. Offer your ideas, suggestions, and advice on how we can all work together to live greener in Michigan. MovingMichiganForward.com, in partnership with Next Energy, is brought to you in part by IBEW Local 58 and NECA Signatory Employers, The Good Food Company, and Charter One.
Got lots of questions on Michigan's green future? Get lots of answers at MovingMichiganForward.com.
MovingMichiganForward.com. Learn, share, grow, make your future green at MovingMichiganForward.com.
How would you like to lose weight for free? Hi, I'm Steve Bostick for Right Size Smoothies.
And I'm Scott Johnson. For a few months now, we've offered an incredible deal to the public. Use Right Size Free for 2 full weeks and see how much weight you can lose before you pay for them.
But some of you haven't called, so we're offering one last chance to take advantage of this popular offer. These people called.
I lost weight in a couple days. Now I'm down 120 pounds.
A free trial sounded like a no-brainer, so I called. Within the first week, I'd lost a lot of weight.
I knew within a few days I had finally found the answer.
I've lost 44 pounds.
Right Size Smoothies contain an appetite manager that knocks out hunger cold. You'll see results early, so you'll know you can do it.
How much weight can you lose in 2 weeks? Try Right Size free and find out. You could be our next testimonial.
For your free 2-week trial, call 1-800-644-1381. 1-800-644-1381. 1-800-644-1381.
Prices include 5% down payment at 7.5% APR over 30 years.
Wow, look at this place. 4 bedrooms, 2 baths.
Yeah, I know.
Geez, you're not even 30. We have the same salary, Maggie. How can you afford all this?
My mortgage payment is less than $300 a month.
What? That's less than I pay for rent. How did you...
All I did was call BNI for a list of homes that are being sold for back taxes or foreclosure.
Home foreclosures are on the rise. That means there are great deals out there, especially for first-time home buyers. Like this listing, a 4-bedroom, 2-bath going for under $20,000. That's just $199 a month. Listings go fast, so call BNI for a list of these homes today. Call 1-800-844-1134.
I could actually afford to own my own home.
Yeah, and it's easy. Just call BNI for the list.
Properties that have been foreclosed or repossessed are a real bargain and sometimes sell for little money down. For a list of homes in your area, call 1-800-844-1134. 1-800-844-1134. That's 1-800-844-1134.
101.1 WRIF, WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
You cannot petition the Lord with prayer!
Well, welcome back.
That's
to
Jim Morrison,
yes,
everybody.
It is. Jillian Jordan is with me. We'll be with you at 313-298-WRIF for the next hour. We're talking, as you can imagine, about the bailout, George Bush getting shoes thrown at him as he spoke in Baghdad. Us wondering why the hell he isn't in Washington trying to work something out that will save the auto companies.
And you out there who are listening, and the lines are full, so I can tell there's a lot of people, but I want to... mentioned Jose in the Bronx.
Yeah.
He said he considers himself a progressive. He is against the bailout, talking more about trade policies being fixed, tariffs increased on foreign trade. That's what he's talking about. But he, at the end, said, yes, please keep up the good work, guys. I listen as often as I can. Honest talk like this you don't find too often anymore on the radio. I would have called in, but our phone has been shut off.
Well,
there's a sign of the times right
Jose,
there.
Actually, I'm sorry, because there's a lot to what you've said about tariffs and the spiraling down of wages, but there's too much here. I can't really read it all. But speaking about religion, there's this Harris poll that just came out. It says more Americans believe in the devil, hell, and angels than in Darwin's theory of evolution.
Yeah, that terrified me, actually, when I read that.
What do we know? Among my immediate, well, here, it says 80% of adult Americans believe in God. I don't have a single friend, a close friend, that believes in God.
Right. I know a lot of people who believe in God. But, yeah, most of the people I hang around are some form of the A word.
Yeah. not A-hole.
No. Yeah. Let's not go on that train again tonight, Peter.
All right, large majorities of the public believe in miracles. 75%. I don't know anybody that believes in miracles. Heaven? I don't know anybody. 73%. Angels.
Angels,
71%.
Yeah. That Jesus is God or the Son of God, 71%. The resurrection, 70%. Survival of soul after death, 68%. Hell, 62%, which is why we have, why so many of them are sinning. Okay,
yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's interesting. Why would there be any sin? Why would there be anybody violating
if they believe all this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's wrong here?
The virgin birth, which is just a big eye roller to me.
61%.
61 and the devil, 59%. Yeah, if you're so damn scared of the devil.
how can 3% of the... less. What do they think? Hell is unattended? 62% of Americans believe that hell exists, but only 59% believe that the devil exists. Let's
good
see.
I like this one. Sizable minorities believe in ghosts, 44%. UFOs, 36%. Witches, 31%. Astrology and reincarnation, 24%.
Yeah, I thought there was some other stuff here as well.
But only 47% believe in Darwin's theory of evolution.
Yeah.
And in creationism, which is 40%.
Well, we're always thought of as a very religious nation, but they let me see, who was it again? Oh, the Harris poll. Remember Drew and Mike, they used to do their own Harris poll. They would call people named Harris, like in southern states.
Yeah, yeah.
That was always fun.
Oh, it's hilarious.
Yes. But let's see. 23% of people, up 2% from last year, only 23% of Americans consider themselves very religious. So why are these politicians always pandering to the very religious? I mean, every single one of them, you know, like Obama and all.
But what else is going on out there, which is probably going to even increase these numbers, is as times are hard, people are finding religion more. Yeah. And these evangelical churches are filling up to the point where they have to put fold-out chairs in other rooms to accommodate the people who, you know, who are finding, and I understand finding comfort, but I don't know. Find it another way. Go take a walk with the dog.
Or how about even more so when it comes to these issues that are really important to us now? Leave your thatched hut, grab your pitchfork, and come out in the public square. And let's make the rulers tremble. They've screwed everything up. But here, not very religious, not at all religious, amounts to 32%. That's a bit of the population, which means...
This 80% number is...
Yeah, right. Somewhat religious is only 45%. So somewhat to not religious at all is, 77%. So why is everybody always going on about religion?
I don't understand it.
Alaska Governor Sarah Palin's church was badly damaged by arson. No laughter, please, Jolene. We don't.
No,
this is not a good idea.
Me?
Leading the governor to apologize Saturday if the fire was connected to, quote, undeserved negative attention from her campaign as the Republican vice presidential campaign. $1 million of damage to the Wasilla Bible Church. This is where, remember, they were doing these kind of...
Oh, they were...
Make her safe from witchcraft.
Yeah.
And, yeah, stuff like that.
Exercising the demons, is that what you call it?
Yeah. But let's see here. Worships acknowledge the possibility that Palin's connection could have been, you know, because of her politics, but more in a maybe sort of way, said Rob Tracy, who shuttled people to the school. They went to an alternate place for services today or yesterday by now. They're speculating about other motives. And let me see, who the hell is Tracy here in this thing? I think he's maybe the minister. But anyways, Tracy said it's just as likely to be some troubled person who has a beef with God. Isn't that weird?
That is,
I mean,
really
if,
weird.
If there really was a God, I mean, you wouldn't start, like, if you have a beef with him. I mean, the guy can put you in a world of hurt.
I guess so.
I mean, he's all powerful.
So
I mean, it's like messing with Superman.
Say. And his kryptonite?
Yeah. Or Doak. Wow, I don't know who Doak is. Said, or some local punks.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah. Okay.
Pete from Imlay City said, hey, Peter, I think it's Jim Morrison's birthday. Thanks for having me on the show. It was actually the 8th, but a happy birthday, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
we love Jim Morrison.
Let's go back and get our phones. Oh, man. Kevin, how did you wind up waiting so long? Thanks for joining us on WRIF. You're on the air.
Hey, what's going on, Peter, Julian?
Hey.
Hey, Kevin.
Merry Christmas.
Okay, thank you.
Happy holidays. I just wanted to say July 24th, I got a job at GM Power Train in Romulus. I passed the drug test, everything, and subcontracting. We did environmental work. And, they never told me how much my wage was. I got my first check. You'll never believe how much I was paid.
How much?
$7.45 an hour.
Oh, okay.
40 hours a week. I work from 6 a.m. to 2:30, and no benefits. And I cleaned bathrooms. You wouldn't believe some of the things I had to clean up. And
are you still there?
No, I quit on September 22nd. I refused to go in. I just had enough of it. I mean, I couldn't deal with it anymore.
Aww. Well, let me ask you this. Given all of that, all the indignity of the wage, the indignity of the work, although, you know, the truth be told, I mean, I know this is easy for me to say, but, you know, some of the worst jobs have to be done. Are you sorry now, given what's happening, that you quit?
Well, actually... Yes, I mean, you know, it's tough for me to say that, but I mean, you know, minimum wage at GM, I was so excited, and then I started getting depressed, I couldn't pay my bills, and then, I don't mind paying child support, but I mean, after taxes and child support, I don't have, I have like $1 left after rent.
Sure.
$1. What is that going to buy me?
You know what? I'll tell you that, Kevin, we haven't heard anybody talk about recently. We were always said, this is the richest country in the world. This is the wealthiest country in the world. We're number one. What are we number one in? These guys have ruined everything. And, you know, can you believe it that they're trying to blame it on a guy and or a woman who is on an auto assembly line? I mean, talk about being in denial about who causes our problems. That's amazing.
Yeah. Anyways, make this quick. I may go back in January, so I do have my fingers crossed, but I just, you know.
They're still hiring? That's amazing.
Pardon me?
It's amazing that they're still hiring.
No. Well, I quit, I just was fed up with depression and such. And
yeah. Well.
Because you got out of there just for your mental health.
Right. But on the other hand, these days, anything is better than nothing. But, all right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call, Kevin. Here's Josh. He's driving. Although we say drive now, talk later, this is an exception we'll make. Josh, hi. It's Peter Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us. Hey. Oh, I know. Hold on. Sorry. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, I like you. Sure. Listen to it all the time.
Thanks. Thank you.
What do you mean you're on the road? Are you driving?
Well, I was.
Oh. Okay.
Go ahead. What were you driving?
Truck.
A truck. Okay.
Big red one.
Okay.
So what's up?
Yeah, can you turn your radio completely off, Josh?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah,
that's
no,
okay.
All right.
It's one of those little details.
Are you back with us?
Yeah.
Okay.
So what's going on, Josh? You just letting us know that you like the show?
Yeah, pretty much. And, I really think it was funny how Bush got his shoe thrown at him. Duck.
Well, it would have really been funny, Josh, if there would have been like about 4 or 5 or 10 or 20 more guys that would have thrown their shoes at him.
That would have been funny.
Yeah.
Well, we're glad you're listening, Josh.
Yeah. Are you just driving around the neighborhood, or are you over the road truck driver?
Just driving over a friend's house.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, and thank you for calling. I appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number, and you're welcome to call. Here's Stephen and Taylor. Stephen, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Going good.
I want to ask you guys something about something I seen earlier today.
Yeah.
While I was walking to a gas station, like, to pay for my gas,
uh-huh.
I was looking at the magazine, and the one had a picture of Barack.
Yeah.
And underneath that picture of Barack, it said not born in the USA. Ford birth certificate signature from life.
Oh, that was a big thing. Someone filed a lawsuit about that it wasn't but it's not. It's not true.
Well, it actually made it up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court refused even to review it. Interestingly, the man who brought the suit said neither Barack Obama nor John McCain were eligible to be the presidency, and neither of them were born in the United States. McCain was born in the Canal Zone. In Panama, and partly everything is politics. I mean, obviously, if somebody would have been born in, Poland or France or something like that, or even like Jennifer Granholm, who was born in Canada,
they're
not going to make any excuses for her. But if McCain won, they would have said, okay, but there's really nothing to this Barack Obama thing. This is the far right wing doing, willing.
Trying to convince you that it's true.
And as usual, they're in this polemic against reality. And so having been completely overwhelmed electorally and politically and philosophically, they're trying to erode confidence in Barack Obama's ability to deal with the problems that we're facing. And this is not the way to go about it, obviously. And it is really just a bunch of BS. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call and bringing that up. Here is Zach. Zach is in Ann Arbor. Zach, hi. You're on WRIF. Go ahead. Zach, are you? Well, I'm sorry, Zach. Wait a minute. Hold on here. I pushed the button and it didn't work. Go ahead, Zach. On the air now.
How you doing, Peter?
Yeah, sure.
All right, good. Yeah, I actually haven't listened to the show since around 2003 when I was like 13. But
wow.
It's
good to know you're still pretty much the same old Peter Orby.
Yeah, well.
That's for sure.
It's worked so far, so.
Yeah. But I was reading a publication called The Nation a couple of days ago, and there was an article in there about how Barack Obama is planning to shut down Guantanamo Bay.
Right.
And the Congress was saying something about that Guantanamo Bay was somehow necessary, and they wanted to make it so you could detain people without charges indefinitely within the United States.
They don't know what to do yet. The Nation, by the way, is an excellent magazine. I read it every single week. And both John McCain and Barack Obama advocated the shutting down of Guantanamo. It's this horrible scar on the reputation of the United States, where torture and the guarantees that one expects in any judicial proceeding were just thrown out the window. Right now, I mean, there were so many people that were held there that have done absolutely nothing, that were sort of just scooped up on the battlefield. Some, there was like 14-year-olds that are arrested and have been there for the, like, 7 years and on and on and on. And, that any of the men, like the five guys who are willing to plead guilty to so-called masterminding the 9/11 assault, they could have been handled just like other people who have made terrorist attacks inside the United States, like the guys that attacked the World Trade Center in the 1990s. They should have been tried immediately as criminals for this hideous criminal act of mass murder and prosecuted. Now, there is some concern that there is a handful of people. There have been hundreds of people there, but there's a handful of them that could represent a danger to the United States, to commit other terrorist acts, or if they haven't, to do ones anew, because the guys did it. They're not going anywhere. They are going to be prosecuted. But there is still some sense of how can we incarcerate people. I mean, the question facing the administrators are, how can we incarcerate people who we don't have enough evidence to try, but we think that maybe they're guilty? Well, that violates the whole concept of American justice. And it's no less true for individual criminals in the United States. I mean, a lot of times police know that somebody probably did something, but the days where you just beat a confession out of somebody it's not entirely gone by a long shot, but it's not done on the regular basis the way it used to. And what happened, of course, there was all these false confessions, all these people that broke under essentially police torture in the same way that many of them broke under torture at Guantanamo or at Abu Ghraib or at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. So Guantanamo was really about extending the executive power of Bush to literally become a dictator, in the sense that he was not going to be constrained by the other branches of government, by the legislative branch or by the judiciary, and also nor by the Constitution. So it's the Guantanamo Bay prison camp is just, I guess, what would you say, a emblematic of everything that's wrong with the Bush administration.
It's baby steps away from concentration camp. And when I say that, I only mean the baby step is calling it a concentration camp, because in basically every other way, it is.
Yeah. Well, it is a disgrace, and Bush will go down as one of the worst presidents and the most vile that has ever, the only way he ever got into office was to cheat his way in twice. I mean, obviously the American people were smart enough in 2000 to have a majority of us vote against them, but because of the shenanigans in Florida and his dad's pals on the Supreme Court, he was able to essentially create a coup. And it became, in many, I don't want to call it a fascist coup, but it was a fascistic coup, so that he would rule undemocratically for the benefit of corporations, which is what the fascists do. All right, Zach, thank you very much. Glad you've been listening for so long. And, as they say, I keep on keeping on. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Jill and Taylor. Hi, Jill. You're on the air.
Talk about the bailout,
please.
I think that if we don't get the bailout, we're all just gonna be screwed.
I think you're right.
I personally don't work in the auto industry, but I know that my business that I do work in is suffering because of it, and along with much of my family suffering because they all have been laid off from their jobs, and they all work like in the steel factories. due to this. And I think that anybody who would be against it is a fool.
Well, I agree. But like I say, it's not just, I don't know if you heard right at the beginning, it was quite a while ago, but one of the things the Republicans want to do is that they see that they can use this as a way to destroy the United Auto Workers. And once that it's twofold. I mean, the UAW is very important to the Democratic Party, in fact, almost critical. And the unions in general, the amount of money that they contributed to the Barack Obama victory. But then, if they can beat back the wages that have been won over the last 75 years by the union movement, if they can beat organized labor, the individual worker is absolutely screwed. If they can get UAW workers working for $14 an hour, what are they going to make the person that has no union protection at all work for, right? Or what benefits?
Right, exactly. I just think that if we don't get the bailout, not only should they just shut down Michigan, because that's all mainly all what we're about, is half of our, you know, United States is just going to fall apart.
You know, I was talking about this the other week. I don't know if this is the week you missed. Universal health plan, right?
Oh, yeah, that would be a wonderful thing.
Yeah. All right, Jill, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. You know, I just, as Jill was talking, Jolene, I had a thought that when things start to spiral down, mm-hmm. and businesses begin to collapse and more people are laid off, and what can very easily happen, particularly if there's a very dramatic downward spiraling, businesses will stop advertising on radio stations.
Yeah, that's so true.
And the advertising, among other things, pays for our salaries.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that... you know, I mean, I think there's bigger fish involved than you and me, but we're part of it all. I mean, it's not like we're going to be impervious to what could happen.
Right. Somehow it affects everyone.
It does. All right. Continuing onward, here is Kenneth in Southfield. Hi, Kenneth. You're on the air.
Oh yeah, how you doing, Peter and Jolene?
Hi.
Yeah, I always enjoy your show.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, oh, I agree with about the wages and everything, Peter. And you know what I was thinking is just because other countries' wages are so low doesn't mean that Americans need to lower their wages, you know, down to compete with other countries. That's ridiculous.
But Kenneth, that is the free market, and that's what we must never, ever allow to govern our wages, because as there's so many people willing to do the work, you're absolutely right. If unions have, and unions were responsible for the minimum wage law come to being as well, but unions raise the wage above what you would get on the market if things were left to its own level. So unless we want to all work for $2 an hour, we better make sure that the workers who are getting the best salaries set the wage standard for the rest of us who aren't. It's that simple.
Oh, yeah, that's so true. That's so true. Peter, you mentioned earlier that you had a bad General Motors car, and I just wanted to mention.
Oh, no, I didn't say what car. I didn't say General Motors.
Yeah, no, you didn't say, but I just wanted to mention my family and I, we always buy General Motors, and they always give us at least a good 10 years.
Well, that's good. I mean, I could have just got a bad one. I'm sure the people with bad Hondas and Toyotas, although I got to say I've never heard of one.
I think they're making them better now. That's why, you know, they're lasting so long, and, you know, the people aren't buying new ones.
Well, actually, this one is a 2001, and it's a full-size sedan, and it only has 56,000 miles on it.
Wow.
It's like our second car.
Yeah. You know,
we don't ever take it on trips or anything like that. But everything is
gone. Sounds like that's a good idea.
I mean, stuff has gone wrong with it that the repair shop where we take it to, they said that they've never heard of that happening. They've never got another job like that before. Mm. The air conditioning went, the rear, oh, let me see, what was it? The shocks have gone. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So, all right, Kenneth, thanks for listening. Appreciate it. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF at 1 o'clock. This does not, you know, sometimes I think when I'm going to introduce a book, people are going to say, whoa, man, this doesn't sound exciting. This is. Robert Justin Goldstein, who's a professor emeritus at Oakland University, has written a book called American Blacklist, The Attorney General's List of Subversive Organizations. This was put together in the late 1940s.
Really?
Of all the subversive groups in the United States, and you caught hell if you were in any of them. And so it's all how it played out. And the important thing is the level of political debate in this country about the major issues. So, like, debate in 2003, in the run-up to the late 2002, early 2003, in the run-up to the Iraq War, was severely limited because of the unwillingness of to allow anybody who opposed the war to have any major platform to speak from. And Robert Goldstein's book, American Blacklist, talks about really the origin of the limit of debate in a country where it's supposed to be democratic, and he discusses all of this. Right? One of the things we have are shows like this, so I appreciate, that's at 1 a.m., by the way. I appreciate all of you participating. If you'd like to email us, calltalks@yahoo.com. By the way, there'll be a podcast of this at by noon today, Monday. And sometimes I have people say, well, you know, podcast, I don't know how to do it. Well, if you just go to WRIF.com or my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, PeterWerbe.com, you can, it'll show you how to hook onto it. And even if you don't have, like, an iPod, you can just listen to it on your computer.
Your Windows Media Player. Just a double click away. It's real easy.
Also, and we never talk about this. Is this all happening, MySpace and Facebook?
It is, thanks to Debbie.
Hi, Debbie, if you're listening in Northampton, Massachusetts. Yeah.
Wonderful friend.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
So if you go to MySpace and you put in, what, just Night Call?
Night Call Show, I believe. Yeah.
It's myspace.com/Night Call Show. And with Facebook,
just search Night Call Detroit. You'll find it. Yeah.
Okay. Let's continue onward. Here's Andy in Highland. Hi. And there's another Andy waiting as well. But this is Andy in Highland. Hi, Andy. Are you a W member?
No, I'm not. Actually, I have a little bit different take on bailout. That's all
okay.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
I just have a few things that I'd like to state, and then I'd like to hear, you know, your response maybe. But
the
first thing is, you know, should off-field UAW workers make as much as an AutoCAD designer or accountant? Should a stock boy at Rite Aid make $20 an hour? And if so, how much did the manager at Rite Aid make an hour?
Wait, go back over. You're saying that people at Rite Aid makes $20 an hour?
Oh, I'm saying, what is the UAW's reason for getting high wages for unskilled labor? I mean, if everybody getting, you know, an unskilled labor got above $20 an hour, obviously the cost of goods are going to skyrocket, no matter what company it was, no matter.
Well, there's too much profit taking, and there has been by the elite, by the wealthy, by the ruling class, by the ultra wealthy, however you want to label them. They've taken too much of the wealth that people working have created for them, and that's one of the reasons we're in the jam that we have so much wealth. This was a whole class war on the part of the wealthy against the middle class and the working class to extract as much wealth from what we produce in order to place it all in this speculative capital in the stock market, which was just this enormous crapshoot. The words at Rite Aid should make $20 an hour. In fact, that would be like it could have been. I mean, now they've screwed up everything. But that if the minimum wage would have been $20 an hour, they would have been a vibrant consumer economy. And these rich people, where is my little letter here? I mean, wouldn't be able to be thinking about buying watches for $40,000 and stuff like that.
Well, I'd like to make another point, if I can.
Sure.
When the UAW members say that, you know, the cost of the labor is less than 10% of the cost of the car, there is some truth to that. But I'd also want to say if, like, the folk American Axle and Delphi were getting, like, $12 an hour, then it would actually be well over 10% of the price of the car to come down. And they don't mention that. I mean, the UAW could decide to go into a competitive market like computers, but how much more would their computers be than their competition if they kept things the way they are? To me, the job base is un-American. That's my belief. I don't believe that it should be there. It's not for any other industry.
Well, they're willing to give it up, which I think is a mistake. I mean, see, I think the world owes you a living, and you owe the world participation. And that used to be an old phrase. The world doesn't owe you a living. Well, why not? Why doesn't a cooperative society of which everyone contributes, whether they're working at Rite Aid or in a factory or they're running a business or they're working at a radio station, why are we seen as partners in a process of community as opposed to this, they don't deserve it because all they're doing is flipping a hamburger or whatever. Somebody's got to flip a hamburger. Someone always going to flip a hamburger as long as the social structure of our society is as it is. and someone's going to be a doctor, and someone's going to be an auto worker, and someone's going to clean toilets, and someone's going to make a decision to say, we got to do this and that. And to disregard labor, to give people not a sense of dignity because they do somehow some disvalued work or that it's easily to repeat. I mean, I'll tell you, I mean, who would you rather took a vacation? All these CEOs that have ruined everything or a janitor?
Well, I admit the CEO is overpaid, but if you have somebody like Bill Gates of Microsoft and he comes out with an operating system and he markets it, well, you know, I don't really believe that, like, his secretary should have to be paid, like, you know, $250,000 a year when it's still a job that, you know, isn't, you know, in as big a demand as, say, like, the programmers that work for him that should, you know, get, like, $200,000.
Well, you know, you sound like a buyer at, you know, at some market as opposed to talking about human beings that, that ought to be able to, you know, participate as much as possible in a society where they don't have to always worry about the, you know, the rent or whether they can get shoes for their kids or they got to, you know, that there's all this glittering stuff that they and, you know, because they watch television all the time and, you know, that all this stuff becomes, takes on such meaning. You know, the compassion level I hear from you is hovering around zero.
Well, it's not to want people to work in sweatshops. I'm sure you'd agree there's a far cry from the UAW wages versus sweatshop. But what I'm saying is a business owner, competition is out there. You can't afford to pay everybody, you know, high wages. Otherwise, you're going to be bankrupt.
Well, you know, that does become a point. Like you compare, like, conditions at Walmart as compared to Costco. Costco virtually invited unionization of their workers. The CEO makes about, was it either 1% or 10% of what the Walmart chief executive, he makes about $23 million. I think the guy that's head of Costco makes about $300,000 or something like that. But they tell the Costco guy, you can't give the health benefits you want because that will lower your stock price. I mean, there's something wrong here. All right, I got to take a quick break. Thanks for your comments. And Lynn Gordon, Peter Werby, 313-298-WRIF. We'll be right back.
This is iCall on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
All right, $90.
All of you who have stuck with me.
By 900,000 citizens.
Through very difficult times.
$10 ahead. I'm not getting much more out of these guys.
I'm sorry.
Good thing you can still text message us at the RIF. Get your request, card info, and your unfair cellular advantage. Text keyword WRIF to 71913. And
I'm sorry.
We'll never be embarrassed here from you.
I would never quit on you.
Log on to WRIF.com for more details. 101 WRIF.
What exactly is telemetrics and what does it mean to me?
Us changing light bulbs save money.
Where are the best places to find organically grown foods?
When will Michigan be seeing inks in green building?
What are some easy steps my family can take to be more green?
How can my coworkers and I start a recycling program at work?
Got lots of questions on Michigan's green future? Get lots of answers at movingmichiganforward.com. You can also join the discussion, offer your ideas, suggestions, and advice on how we can all work together to live greener in Michigan. MovingMichiganForward.com, in partnership with Next Energy, is brought to you in part by IBEW Local 58 and NECA Signatory Lawyers, the Good Food Company. Charter One.
Got lots of questions on Michigan's green future? Get lots of answers at MovingMichiganForward.com.
MovingMichiganForward.com. Learn, share, grow, make your future green at MovingMichiganForward.com.
If the IRS tells you that you still owe back taxes, what can you do? Or if the state tax collector threatens you with wage garnishments, penalties, or seizures, what are your options? As an honest, hard-working American, you do have rights. If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Just call 800-493-8159. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debts for less than you owe. Remove penalties and interest and get the collector off your case. Don't let your tax problem get worse. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 800-493-8159. That's 800-493-8159.
Your credit card debt is getting out of control. You're having trouble making the monthly minimums. Sound familiar? You have to do something, but what?
well, you don't have to file for bankruptcy. Mortgage brokers want you to put up your family home to pay off credit card debts. Problem is that more often than not, you find yourself using the credit cards again. Only this time there's no equity left in your home, and you have a whole new pile of credit card debt. It doesn't have to be this way. We're Credit Card Relief. We help people just like you get out of debt in months instead of years and save you thousands of dollars. Call now for a free consultation. We're an attorney-driven program with an excellent reputation. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 1-866-290-8282. 1-866-290-8282. Not available in all states. 1-866-290-8282.
The time of year again. The 12 days of Rhythmus are back. Get hooked for the holidays with a list. Big old bag this year. Tickets galore, including Metallica, Nickelback, Slipknot, New Year's Eve at the Hollis with the Pistons and Nets. Sign Metallica's set list, a Sangat HD radio receiver, and more. Just listen for Santa Pooba to wish you happy holidays for your chance to win. It's the 12 days of Rhythmus.
Listen and win.
From 101 WRIF. Everything rocks. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
And they've been eating us for generations, right? Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, we're here with you till 1 a.m. Taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF. Someone actually sent me a snail mail.
Wow, a rarity.
Yeah, Al, listening in Ann Arbor, sent this. He said, hello, Peter. Here are a couple of catalog items that make the New York Times merchandise look like thrift shop listings.
The reason we always talk about New York Times, you see a horrible story about Iraq or someone who's died, and next to it will be
a purse
that's $5,000.
Anyway, so he's suggesting I do something, and you can tell by the fact that I'm going to read this that I'm not going to do it. It's a surprise Jalene with the Cartier fountain pen on air. Even without video, her reaction would be priceless.
I'm sure.
Yeah. And let's see. If funds are a little tight this year, you can show Jalene the catalog listing instead of actually giving her the pens. After all, it's the thought that counts. You will not believe this. The pen set that he is talking about, you know, I can't even pronounce this. Cartier Exceptional Inseparable, something rather, de Cartier. This is two fountain pens. Take a guess.
For two fountain pens?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. $500?
Come on.
Really?
Yeah, come on. We could spend a lot of time at this.
Yeah.
$320,000.
Oh, for two pens?
Yeah. There's two. It's inspired by Lovebird jewelry pieces created in 1926. A set of two fountain pens made of solid 18-karat gold and enamel paved with 411 diamonds.
Well, you didn't tell me that part.
The male has 326 diamonds totaling almost 8 carats and 2 emeralds. The female has 85 diamonds totaling 2.15 carat and 2 sapphire. Both sit on a sterling silver perch adorned with 3 onyx capuchons? Something, I don't know. Each set is individually numbered out of 10. So we've only made 10.
Oh, my.
And then, well, come on, man. This is ridiculous. But they got
it's
some.
It's really ridiculous. And we can keep track of pens around here the way it is.
Here's 100 and, yeah, wouldn't you be a little nervous? 110,000. But if you really, you know, if you're starting to, the times are tough. Here's one, another fountain pen, 26,000. Oh, another one, St. St. DuPont, the Diamond Rain. It's 46,000. I thought I saw some cheaper ones here. Oh, yeah. $1,380.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, perfect.
Okay, one word, Bic.
Right. There you go, indeed. Are we at a point where we got to go through these calls a little faster?
Okay.
All right, here's JR in Lincoln Park. JR, hi. It's WRF, Peter Werby, and Gene Jordan. You're on the air with us.
Ms. Jordan, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Pretty good. One time I was listening to Riff, I heard you on Night Call. I'm like, what is she doing with Peter Werby? How are you, Peter Werby?
I'm good.
All right. Now, yeah, real quick. Okay. I was telling him to answer the phone. Who decides how much the House representatives, how much, you know, or anybody who works at the House, you know, how much money do they make, and are they suffering as much as we are? And my answer to that, just me in my head, is probably no.
Well, they decide themselves what their salary
is.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be nice if we all get together in our little factory or office and say, okay, let's take a vote. How should we get? You know what? That would work out very well. Because if the employers, and this has happened in periods in history and in other countries where workers have had tremendous power and they have what they call workers' councils, yet there's still private ownership. They get together and they tell the management, how much is this enterprise producing? And so they look and they think, okay, the guy's the owner, he's got to get this much, but we're working here and we have to get this much. Now, obviously, we're not going to bankrupt the company. Even if the UAW workers were making an amount that put the integrity of the company in doubt, it still was the guys at the top that made the decision to grant those wages, right?
Oh, well, my point was more like, you know, if we get the people who are making all the money in the state to come down on their salaries, would that kind of, you know, release a chokehold on the state economy, you know? Would that make a little bit of a dent?
Well, you know, CEO pay, it sort of represents, in, you know, its obscene nature of that people can buy fountain pens like this. But even CEO pay, these guys that are making millions, that's not really, I mean, we're talking billions and billions here, but it is just representative of the out of control nature of these, these enterprise. All right, thanks, appreciate your call. Here with us is Randy in Westland. Randy, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to comment on the caller before the last caller.
Sure.
He seemed to be quite an idiot. I don't think he's ever worked a physical job in life. I think anybody that works in a factory, especially an auto factory, is underpaid, even at $28 an hour or $26 an hour. I worked in a factory at Ford Motor Company for 12 and a half years, and I know a lot of people think, UAW workers are spoiled, they're overpaid, they get away with this and that. And until they've actually done it, they have no idea what they're talking about. I'd like to see some of them people last a week in a factory, let alone 12, 20 years or years. And to even ask people to give up stuff that were promised stuff when they first started working at a factory, hey, stick with this job. 30 years, you get a pension, you get this, you get that. So that's the light at the end of the tunnel, the carrot on the end of the stick. I'm going to stick it out. This is a real rough job. It's real physical. It's, very tedious. You have no idea how many hours you're ever going to work when you come in. You may work 8 hours. You may work 10 hours. You may work 12 hours. You have no say in it. You can't say, okay, 8 hours is up, I go home. They tell you when it's time to go home.
Right, and the guys at the top, they live Gross Point, and if you're lucky, and if you're, you know, on the factory floor, if you really work a lot of overtime, instead of just spending 40 hours a week in some noisy, polluted factory, you get to live in Sterling Heights. Maybe if you're on one of the supplier ends, you live in Taylor or Hazel Park or someplace like that. So it doesn't work out to be what one would have a sense of democratic sharing of what is produced and how it's produced and all that. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it very much. So let's see here.
And I'm getting really sick of guys named Todd.
And hey, Todd, welcome to the show.
How's it going?
It's going good.
We were just saying tonight before the show, where has Todd been?
Oh, I listen to you guys. Trust me. You guys are like a bad car wreck. I just can't turn away.
Well, we appreciate that.
All right. Peter, I got to ask you. I'm probably sure I've asked you this 100 times. Why is it people who share the same ideas that you share, why do you think that you should be able to tell owner companies what it is that they do with their money?
Why do you think, let me ask you this, why do you think an owner of a company should be told that you can't have an 8-year-old working in front of a machine 12 hours a day? Who in the world gave the owner a right to, took away his right to have child labor like there used to be in the 19th century?
Those are common laws. Those are designed so you're not mistreating a child, Peter.
Wait a minute. But the employers fought like hell. Just like now, the McDonald's franchise is trying to mobilize all of its outlets to this anti-union campaign. But, there are, just like we decided at one point, we do not want to allow kids to work in factories, just like we decided that that there's actually going to be a weekend, just like we decided that there's going to be health and wage benefits, that there's going to be a 40-hour week, and on and on and on, social decisions came about how the commonwealth that's produced will be shared. It's called distribution of wealth. You come down on the side of this small elite of rulers that screwed everything up. What will it do to shake your confidence, Todd?
Well, I just think that what you're doing is you're taking away somebody's right to their own money. you are removing somebody's right to do with what they want with their own money.
Well, what about a minimum wage? A minimum wage and union wages are above market value. If we actually take away from an employer, we redistribute wealth, because if we left it all to the market, it's very possible that people could be working at $2.75 an hour and auto workers would be making $8 an hour. Where did that, quote, right come from, and isn't that taking away a right of an employer? I just don't give absolute right to ownership.
Well, no, because that's not true. Because if you were to pay somebody $2.75 an hour, or pay everybody $2.75 an hour, like you're saying, then those wages wouldn't supply the market, because nobody would be able to buy the goods that are being produced. So everything balances out.
Well, wait a minute. Then why are conservatives trying to always drive down the price of labor? Why are they doing everything they can to destroy unions? Well, you know what? You had a little breath there. That means we've got to move on because there's just a few, you know, we'll pick it up another time, Don. All right, thanks for your call. Let's see, here's Brent. Where are you calling from? Brent, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm from Hull.
Okay, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm Peter.
Good.
I was just a caller, I don't know, like 9 times ago, was talking about the auto industry. And just to reminisce, back in the 1990s, do you remember when like Cadillac were given 300,000-mile warranties?
Was it that long? That much? Anyways, go ahead. Quick, we're kind of running out of time.
Yeah, well, my hat's off to them, because I own two out of the big three vehicles, and they're still running strong. I have to do minor maintenance on them.
How old are the cars, Brent? How old are the cars?
84 Trans Am, 96 Ford F-150.
Really?
Okay. Yeah.
I just might have got a lemon.
The truck is a work truck, and I drive it in the dirt, but it's still running.
Yeah, that's good.
And I get the work done. I'm just, did they shoot themselves in the foot by making the vehicles too good, you know?
I mean, they last too long?
I have to give them credit.
I don't know. I don't know, Brent. I don't think, you think of a Detroit car lasting over 100,000 miles, you're doing good. What's the mileage on these?
The truck is 196.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, and
that's what it should.
Well, the PA is a show car, so yeah. It was specially made. It's been in Autorama shows around the world.
Really?
I inherited it from my mom. I'm still keeping it going.
Very good.
But by making, you know, such a good product, I'm wondering if that's what's falling back on this.
Well, I don't know. That's really the first I heard of someone thinking that Detroit was making cars that were too good, that they were lasting too long. All right, I got to go through some of these calls. You know, there's, why can't I think of his name? It's the actor. It's his brand new film called Gran Torino.
Clint
Eastwood. Yeah, that looks like a very, very interesting film.
It sure does.
Yeah. All right, let's take some more calls real quickly. Here, it's Andy at Michigan Center. Where's Michigan Center, Andy?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Is that a name of a city?
Michigan? Yeah, it's over by Jackson, Michigan.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, a couple things about wages. You know, the trickle-down theory didn't work during Louis XV's time for the serfs, and didn't work any better now. My dad used to be a custodian in the Pontiac school system. He made about what the Pontiac factory workers made. And, you know, everybody benefited from that, because he raised four kids, and all of us had college educations and contributed on the public, you know, with the public school education and everything. And I think the world is a better place for him getting a decent wage. Now,
sure. Now
my brother works for a company, and they were setting up a place in Mexico, and so much for fair wage down there, they have a law saying you can't pay over a certain amount to workers.
Wonderful.
So they have a maximum amount, and here, you know, we're trying to get a little bit more. So, I mean, you know, there's no fair competition for American products and or American labor. And the other thing I want to mention is, you know, with all these things that we import, I don't know why we don't just put a little bit of a price increase or a tax on each container that comes on a ship and use that money to pay our people that inspect cargo.
Well, that's called tariffs, and that's a whole other deal. I mean, once the tariffs were dropped, all this World Trade Organization, all this globalization that we signed onto, I should say they did. That was just another nail
protesting
in our coffin. All right, I got to run. Thank you very much. Let me see. Here is Dante in Rochester Hills. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. I love the show. Good.
Got me about 1 minute's worth because we're out of here.
Okay, I'll fire it out. Okay, first of all, the jobs bank I hear people complaining about. Toyota also has a jobs bank, has more people in the jobs bank than any of the big three. It's a program they use when they're retooling to have workers that are ready that are trained to save costs, and that's the way it works in this country. Another thing, too, people talk about union entitlements. That's a sickness in this country, the way that they distribute wealth and distribute value of labor. The small business owner, if he can't make it on his own, if he can't pay a living wage, well, he's not entitled to own a business. He should work for somebody else.
I agree with you. All right, we're going to have to leave it at that because we got to go home. Thanks for all that information. Very, very important. Well, fellow peasants, let's assemble in the public square with our pitchforks.
Yes.
We'll meet tomorrow. Thank you, Jalene Jordan. Thanks to all of you for listening and calling. And stay tuned for a couple of very interesting interviews.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. On your radio, on your computer, and now on your brand new iPhone 3G. Your new Apple iPhone 3G connects you to 101 WRIF from anywhere in the world.
Damn, I could get you
on. Run and listen worldwide at WRIF.com.
The RIF.
In national news, the New York Mint is leasing to the public a limited number of $100 Union Silver coins. At the end of this broadcast, we'll provide a toll-free number you can call to receive free information and a free DVD. Sketches of the coin were recently discovered deep in the vaults of the Smithsonian. The $100 Union was proposed by George T. Morgan, who also designed the Morgan Silver Dollar. It was to be the largest coin ever in size and denomination, and it weighs in at a hefty 1.5 ounces. In a startling announcement, the New York Mint plans to lease a limited quantity of $100 Union Silver coins to the public. The silver $100 Union proofs are available on a first-come, first-served basis by calling 1-800-957-5473. Please dial carefully. To receive the free collector's DD containing the full story on this and many other coins, the number is 1-800-957-5473. That's 1-800-957-5473.
How would you like to lose weight for free? Hi, I'm Steve Bostick for Right Size Smoothies.
And I'm Scott Johnson. For a few months now, we've offered an incredible deal to the public. Use Right Size Free for 2 full weeks and see how much weight you can lose before you pay for them.
But some of you haven't called, so we're offering one last chance to take advantage of this popular offer. These people called.
I lost weight within a couple days. Now I'm down 120 pounds.
A free trial sounded like a no-brainer, so I called. Within the first week, I'd lost a lot of weight.
I knew within a few days I finally found the answer. I've lost 44 pounds.
Right Size Smoothies contain an appetite manager that knocks out hunger cold. You'll see results early, so you'll know you can do it.
How much weight can you lose in 2 weeks? Try Right Size Free and find out. You could be our next testimonial.
For your free 2-week trial, call 1-800-644-1381. 1-800-644-1381. 1-800-644-1381.
If you want a new computer, but think you can't get credit terms, listen to this. Now you're approved for a brand new Dell, HP, or other name brand computer for just $29.99 a week. There's no credit check, no hassles, and you won't be turned down. Just call Trex Country at 1-800-990-2258. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, you're approved for a new computer, guaranteed. Even if you have bad credit or no credit, you will not be turned down. And with Trex Country's program, you could also improve your credit rating. Call Tronics Country now and you can own a lightning fast computer or wireless laptop with no hassles or delays. Call right now and with your paid purchase, you'll also get a free 20-inch LCD TV and a free color printer. Call Tronics Country right now at 1-800-990-2258. 1-800-990-2258. That's 1-800-990-2258.
If you have acne, here's a phone number you need to call. 1-800-335-4191. Right now, we're looking for the biggest skeptics out there to test out a skin-clearing breakthrough risk-free. People who are sick and tired of wasting money on acne products that just don't work. If that's you, give us a call. We're going to prove you can make your acne disappear and have clear skin by sending you a 60-day trial of Proactive Solution absolutely risk-free with our compliments. Find out how to get your risk-free 60-day trial by calling 1-800-335-4191. Our Carnation Therapy System uses prescription-grade acne medicine and soothing spa-quality botanicals to create a powerful acne-fighting system. It's so effective, it transforms blemishes and bumps into clear, smooth skin and skeptics into believers. You can have beautiful, healthy-looking skin. Put to the test and we'll prove it. Get your risk-free 60-day trial by calling now toll-free 1-800-335-4191. 1-800-335-4191.
Are the arteries in your home clogged? The damaging limescale from hard water is like blockage in your pipes. It affects your water pressure and costs you more than you realize in energy repairs and appliance replacement, as much as $1,200 a year. Now, there's an easy solution to hard water problems that puts more flow in your system and avoids salts, chemicals, and magnetic coils. It's HydroCare, the patented unit sold worldwide. HydroCare is tested by energy utilities and is totally maintenance-free. Just clip it onto your water pipe, and HydroCare will break up and prevent limescale buildup in your appliances and throughout your plumbing system, guaranteed. Limescale buildup can mean higher energy costs. If your home's reduced water pressure, get those old pipes flowing again. Call HydroCare right now for free information. Call 1-888-889-6126 or log on to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now 1-888-89-6126.
People matter in celebrating those relationships.
At 101.1 WRIF, HD Detroit.
Now, my colleague back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Now that George Bush is in his final weeks, many are looking back on his administration as the worst assault on civil liberties that has ever occurred. And many people think that it all started, that assault on our First Amendment guarantees, may have started in 2001. Well, unfortunately, the defense of the First Amendment rights and an attack on them go back pretty deeply in American history. There was a period called McCarthyism, many know, in the 1950s, when so much was done that we look back on with dismay. And one of them was the U.S. Attorney General's list of subversive organizations. And there's a new book out that is the first examination of the list and its implications for today. The book is called American Blacklist. The subtitle is exactly what it is, the Attorney General's list of subversive organizations. The author joining me is Robert Justin Goldstein, and he is a professor emeritus of political science at Oakland University here in Rochester, Michigan. He's written many books, including Political Repression in Modern America from 1870 to Present, and Flag Burning and Free Speech. Let's welcome Robert Dustin Goldstein to the Peter Werby Show. Hello.
Hi, glad
here. Now, we're reaching you in Ann Arbor, so you're right here in our general area. And looking at the title of these other two books, talking about political repression up to the present, Flag Burning and Free Speech, which is about contemporary issues. Now, you say in American Blacklist that after 1954, the Attorney General's list of subversive organizations began to lose its power. Half a century later, what was your interest in this?
Well, actually, this is a book that has been gestating in my head and my body for a very, very long time. I grew up in Washington, D.C. My parents moved there in 1950. My father was a federal employee. One of the things that I always thought was a little odd was that my father never talked about politics, even the privacy of his home. He never even said whether he had voted, much less who he voted for or his political views. And I think in retrospect, I was his little kid, so I didn't really quite understand why at the time. But I think in retrospect, it may well have been because of the effects of things like the Attorney General's list of subversive organizations, which from now on I'm going to call AGLOSO. That's an acronym for it. Otherwise, I'll be spending a whole interview saying Attorney General's list of subversive organizations. There was a lot of fear among federal employees in Washington during this period. You mentioned, you referred to it in the context of McCarthyism, and actually one of the many purposes of the book is to try to disabuse people of the notion that what I prefer to call the post-World War II Red Scare should be called McCarthyism. Senator Joseph McCarthy only appeared on the scene in early 1950. The Red Scare, which was largely propelled by AGLOSO, which was an aspect of the Truman administration's 1947 federal loyalty screening program. The Red Scare really dates at least to 1947, and many of the worst abuses of the Red Scare were originated by the Truman administration.
Well, let me stop you right there. Now, this, of course, flies right in the face of history that here Truman is liberal administration that we associate anti-communism and its oppression with the Republicans. Give us a context of 1947 and why this list of subversive organizations even appeared.
Well, it's a very interesting period, and I think the context is quite interesting. Let me first give you, let's say, the simple context, and then maybe I can get into a little bit more of the complex context. The simple context of GLOSO and the Truman Loyalty Program and many other steps of the Truman administration did that greatly foster the Red Scare, including the use of political criteria for refusing admittance of people trying to gain entry into the United States, and using political criteria for deporting and denaturalizing people and taking away passports, and beginning to prosecute the top leadership of the American Communist Party, not for trying to overthrow the government, but essentially they were essentially prosecuted because they read books of Marx and Lenin, which advocated the overthrow of communism. So many things. I think you have to look at the context of the Truman administration was being criticized by the right, by the Republicans, for being too soft on communism. So part of Agloso and these other steps were an attempt to defuse these attacks on the right. But the Truman administration also was trying to defuse attacks on its foreign policy from the left. This is something that we've had totally disappeared down the American memory hole, which is that the inauguration of the Truman administration's hardline anti-communist foreign policy, which is mostly associated with the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan, and which were inaugurated at the same time as Agloso and the loyalty program in early 1947, a lot of people on the left argued that the Truman administration was needlessly antagonizing Russia, and that his foreign policy was going to lead to an endless arms race and an endless Cold War, and so on and so forth. And whether or not one agrees with that criticism, and I think that one can make a fairly strong case that it's valid. Certainly, in a democracy, one should have the right to express those views and have them fully debated. And one of the results of the Truman administration's steps to essentially target everyone to their left as tinko, commie, soft on the commies, etc., was to destroy any possibility of domestic debate on the validity of his foreign policy. So the simple context, let's say, but actually I sort of smuggled the more complex part into it. I don't think I have to move on. The simple, more complex context was that the Truman administration wanted to defuse criticism from the right that was soft on communism and to tag all criticism on the left as pro-communist and eco or sympathetic to the communists. So there was sort of double-barreled purpose to all of these steps. And again, I do want to stress that a lot of these key steps were initiated by the Truman administration in 47 and also in 48. There certainly was pressure from the right, and there were activities in Congress, particularly the well-publicized investigations of the House Un-American Activities Committee. It wasn't just the executive branch. But all these things were set in motion well before anyone had ever heard of Senator Joseph McCarthy, who came to prominence in February of 1950. Things were very well advanced, and the term McCarthyism is really a misnomer. Unfortunately, once a misnomer like this gets set into the public mind, it's almost impossible to get rid of it. But it's a huge mistake to think of what happened after World War II in terms of domestic repression and anti-communism as due to Joseph McCarthy. That's so incorrect.
I stand corrected, and I appreciate that from Robert Justin Goldstein. Sure. The book is American Blacklist, the Attorney General's List of Subversive Organization. It's published by the University Press of Kansas,
right.
And there'll be a link on my website to it as well. Now, this was a period after World War II when that suddenly there was this old war. There was this belief, I think it turns out to be incorrect after all, that this conflict with the Soviet Union was coming. There was a worldwide contest for domination, and the charge was, as you said, that that many of these organizations were actually front groups for the Communist Party or had radical programs of their own and represented a danger to American democracy. Does a government, or in this case, this particular government, the Truman administration, did it have any justification for listing these groups?
Okay, well, that's certainly a very good and a very complicated question that definitely deserves an answer. Before I get into it, I should probably mention that I do have my own program for an economic stimulus to help write our economy. If every American bought only 5 copies of my book, can you imagine what that would do for the economy?
Okay.
So moving on.
Yes.
We know from both the public testimony of Truman administration spokesman, and his leading spokesman was the Attorney General of the United States, a guy named Tom Clark, who later went on to serve on the Supreme Court, and whose son later became Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who's viewed as a liberal during the Johnson administration. We know from the public testimony of Clark that one of the purposes of a GLOSO was to tag critics of the Truman administration as subversive and pro-commie and to shut up debate. I mean, we have we have public testimony in Congress like this along these lines. For example, Clark told Congress that one of the major goals of a GLOSO, and I'm quoting directly from his congressional testimony, he said one of a GLOSO's major goal was to render designated organizations, quote, impotent, unquote, by exposing their purposes to the, quote, vaccine of public opinion, unquote, so they could no longer be, quote, used for subversive propaganda, unquote, or to promote, quote, alien philosophy, unquote. Now notice, there isn't any charge here that they were trying to overthrow the government. He's saying that they exposed alien philosophies and subversive propaganda. Now, if there's anything that the First Amendment of the Constitution means, it means we should have complete freedom of speech in the United States as long as people aren't trying to, you know, organize overthrows of the government, and they're not throwing stones through buildings or storming the White House. So first of all, completely reject the idea that the government has any business whatsoever in officially designating which organizations are acceptable and which are not. And this is what a GLOSO was about. I think I should take a minute just to explain what a GLOSO was, in case some of your listeners are really not familiar with this.
Let's remind people every once in a while, in case they're just joining us, that's the Attorney General's list of subversive organizations.
Absolutely.
GLOSO. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. I'm using an acronym. So beginning in 1947, as part of a federal loyalty screening program in which for the first time in American history, every single federal employee and every applicant for federal employment, from janitors in the Agriculture Department to the Secretary of State, had to undergo screening for loyalty. Now, loyalty wasn't defined very well, but one of the criteria for determining whether or not people were loyal were if they were, and I'm quoting directly here, if they were members of, affiliates of, or had sympathetic association with organizations that were designated on the Attorney General's list. Now, of course, what sympathetic association means is pretty difficult to tell. And so later during this interview, I think I'll give you some examples of the kind of absurdities that led to. And the really terrible thing about this list is that the government just began to publish these lists. There was no advance notice to the organizations involved. They were not granted the opportunity for hearings. The government presented no evidence. There were no charges of anything in particular they did. The government would just publish these lists and say these organizations were designated under the Truman Administration Loyalty Program, and in the context of the early Red Scare that the Truman Administration was whipping up, for the reasons that I just said, there's massive media publicity, and these organizations and the possibility of any kind of dialogue and intelligent discussion about the nature of American foreign policy was basically killed. The organizations, as I said, they were not charged with any illegal activities. They were basically just charged with having really bad ideas.
What happened to the people that belonged to them? You said you obviously wouldn't get employment. What if you were a member of one of them and you're also a federal employee?
Well, you definitely were going to come under investigation. You very well might be subject to loyalty proceedings. A minute ago, I just mentioned that you could get in difficulty even if you had sympathetic association to one of these groups. Now, remember again, these groups are listed without any process at all. No notice, no hearings, no evidence, no charges. When employees who were alleged to have ties with these groups were charged with disloyalty, basically, they were entitled to hearings. But often the charges against them were extremely vague. The charges often were based on information from the FBI. The FBI did not want to make the names of their informants public, and often the information was based on illegal FBI activities like wiretaps and burglaries without warrants. So people didn't know the source of the charges, which, again, were often very vague. So they couldn't cross-examine their accusers. They didn't know who they were. And people were literally charged with, and I know this will sound like I'm making up, but I'm not. People were literally charged with things like, you have, for many years, had a close and continuing sympathetic association with
your father, who was a member of one of these organizations, or who was on the mailing list of one of these organizations, or people were charged with having roommates who were affiliated with one of these organizations. I mean, truly bizarre, you know, Kafkaesque, as in effect, author Franz Kafka, who wrote about, you know, it was a nightmare to be caught in endlessly vague charges.
By bureaucrats. Robert Justin Goldstein, let's bring this a little personal, both you and me, when both of us, we talked earlier, when both of us went down for our pre-production draft physical during the Vietnam War, we were handed this list. We were told we had to say whether we were belonged to any, and I was disappointed that none of the groups that I belonged to were on there. And I said, I refused at the Fort Wayne, I refused to say, I said, I'm not making any public statement about what could be possible illegal activity. What would have happened if I would actually belong to one of those, which I didn't? Would they have refused an induction? Do you know that?
I think I can tell you, but I'm not positive because I was not running the military or running the draft boards. I was presented with such a list when I had my draft induction physical in Chicago, and it was in my case it was either in 1968 or in 1969. Now, Ogosa sort of flourished between the time it was inaugurated in 1947 and until the post-World War II Red Scare, as I call it, McCarthyism, as it's become known erroneously, as I suggested, until that Red Scare or McCarthyism began to gradually dissipate after about 1955, Ogosa kind of lost the previous support that it had. Part of the reason for this was that in 1951, the Supreme Court handed down a very vague and complicated ruling in which it basically said organizations proposed for Ogosa listing had to be given some kind of opportunity to rebut these charges. And I discovered in the course of doing my research for this book, I was able to obtain previously secret documents through Freedom of Information Act requests to the Justice Department and the FBI. And one of the things they disclosed was that the Justice Department basically decided to stop adding organizations to Ogosa after 1955 and to stop contesting court cases that were brought by Ogosa listed organizations. So those few organizations which had survived their listing and had the resources to bring a court case, because they were deathly afraid that if Ogosa got to the Supreme Court again, that the whole list would be struck down, that the Supreme Court would say, as I certainly believe, that it's not a proper function of government to be listing organizations as officially approved or officially disapproved by government. So with the end of listing further Ogosa groups after 1955, and with the gradual diminution of the Red Scare and all its intensity, which not all the same as saying it went away, because I'd argue the long-term impact of the Red Scare has had enormous and continuing impacts on the United States, including how we got into the Vietnam War without any real debate, how we got into the Iraq War without a whole lot of debate. The importance of Ogosa per se gradually diminished after 55. So even though it was continued to be officially used right until 1974, President Nixon abolished it under some complicated circumstances that maybe we'll get to. It survived to 74, but it lost its importance, and the general public awareness of it, which was intense at its height.
Well, let's do this, because we have only 5 minutes left.
Okay.
The book is American Blacklist, the Attorney General's List of Subversive Organizations. Fascinating look, not just at history, but something that affects debate, a political debate today. The author is Robert Justin Goldstein. He's with us. And tell us about Coleman Young and how he ran afoul of this Attorney General's List of Subversive Organizations. I believe he belonged to something called the National Negro Council.
Among other groups. I will answer that, but let me just give you a 30-second answer to your last question, which I never quite answered. The answer is, by C9, it's so lost importance that even if you refuse to answer this draft question, which I did, it didn't matter. It wasn't taken seriously. I refused to answer because I didn't think it was any of the government's business, and I was hoping it would get me out of the draft. But even though I refused to answer, they still qualified me as draft eligible. Periodically, Young's affiliation with National Negro Congress, and I believe he was also affiliated with another Ogosa group called the Council on African Affairs. Periodically it would surface, and there were allegations that, you know, Young had these commie ties. But, you know, as I said, after 55, Ogosa per se kind of lost its importance, and, you know, it clearly didn't interfere seriously with with Young's career, and he went on to be, of course, elected the mayor of Detroit.
However, he had a famous confrontation with a House Un-American Activities.
Yes, he did.
And
he did.
That was so popular with him standing up to the Southern racist who chaired that it was that the testimony was actually issued at a 78 RPM and was a wild bestseller in the black neighborhoods of that time.
I'm not a native Detroiter, and that's something I'm interested to hear, and that's something I didn't really know.
Well, I'm just laughing at the thought of it, and they went around and around about the pronunciation of Negro, which the Southerners had trouble with.
Okay.
You know, we have only about 3 minutes left, so I'm going to kind of leave it to you, Robert Justin Goldstein, to give us a bit of a summation in this work on your book, American Blacklist. And as I said, it's you tied it into the run-up to the Iraq War. How could that be? This is 50 years old.
Right. Well, this particular book basically amounted to a 400-page expansion of one page in my first book, which was my PhD dissertation at the University of Chicago, which was called Political Repression in Modern America. It's still in print, but I'd be want to buy another book. And the point is that there's been a long, even we think of ourselves the land of the free and all that stuff with the Statue of Liberty representing us. In fact, there has been a long history of restrictions on political dissent in the United States, and the cumulative effect of those restrictions, of which Agloso is just one tiny little example, is that in fact, often people are really afraid to express their views. They are afraid it can be portrayed as somehow subversive or pico or soft on communism or soft on terrorism, etc. So the long accumulation of things like the Attorney General's list and things that people call McCarthyism and similar repression of dissent during World War One and often suggestions that people opposed to the Vietnam War were sympathetic to communism or under communist control and suggestions that people were against the Iraq War are soft terrorism, they eroded our First Amendment freedoms. They've made people afraid to talk, discussing freely. So they've really, these kinds of things have really harmed our democracy. And they've also contributed to weird things like the fact that we have the most unequal distribution of income in a Western industrialized world and the highest rate of poverty. And we're the only country without a system of national health insurance. It's because even talking about such ideas is enough to get you labeled as sort of a crypto-commie or a terrorist subversive. And so the crimping of our political dialogue has had profound effects on our political system. And ultimately, that's really what I'm trying to get at. But it's pretty hard to study that massive subject. You have to chop it out of pieces. So this is a little piece.
I would say a good piece of it is American Blacklist, the Attorney General's List of Subversive Organizations. It's up by University Press of Kansas. You go to kansaspress.ku.edu. There'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Robert Justin Goldstein has been my guest. Thanks so much for telling us about your book.
Oh, well, glad to hear. Thanks for asking.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
It's that time of year again. The 12th day of Rhythmus are back.
Get hooked up with our honeys with a list. We'll go next year.
Tickets galore.
Including seats in rows 12 through 1 for Trans-Siberian Orchestra December 21st. Gifts for her. East End Blues, Love's Lane. Digital music downloads and more.
Just listen for Santa Poobah to wish you happy holidays. Your chance to win is 12 days of Rhythmus.
Listen and win.
From 101 WRIR. Everything that rocks.
What could be the biggest financial setback of your life? It's not losing a bet or making a bad investment. It's bankruptcy. And if you have too much credit card debt, you may be closer than you ever imagined. If you have over $12,000 in credit card debt, call an advocate who understands debt problems and how to fix them. Your advocate is Debt Settlement USA. Call for a free consultation at 1-877-560-8877. Debt Settlement USA has a proven debt reduction program that can cut the amount you owe and get you out of debt faster than you could on your own. If you have over $12,000 in credit card debt, call Debt Settlement USA for a free consultation. 1-877-560-8877. Your call is confidential with no obligation. Not available in all states. Debt Settlement USA can help you get out of debt faster than you think. Call now. 1-877-560-8877. That's 1-877-560-8877.
Does your furnace need repair? Your house need cleaning? Or maybe you're ready to update your kitchen? Big or small, whatever your home improvement need. Now it's easy to find the right home pro for your project. Log on to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic is a free online resource with instant access to pre-screened remodelers, aides, handymen, roofers, and many other home contractors. Just go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic has a network of licensed and insured contractors in hundreds of home improvement categories. If you need a painter, electrician, plumber, or any other home service, visit fixitfast.servicemagic.com.
SuccessServiceMagic.com. It's easy and it's free, and it's the source to find neighbor recommended contractors in your area. Now you can hire a pre-screened home pro with confidence. Go to FixItFast.ServiceMagic.com. It's quick, it's free, and there's no obligation. Go to FixItFast.ServiceMagic.com. That's FixItFast.ServiceMagic.com.
If your credit card debt has gotten out of control, if you're over your head at money payments, here's one powerful secret the credit card companies don't want you to know. You have the right to settle your credit card debt for a fraction of what you owe, allowing you to cut your debt up to half or more. That's bad news for credit card companies, but it's great news for you. We're Consumer Debt Advocate, and we'd like to offer you a free consultation that will help you start eliminating credit card debt. For your free consultation that will set you free, call 1-800-984-6953. Don't ruin your credit by declaring bankruptcy. Settle your debt and move on with your life. During your free consultation, you'll find out what the credit card companies don't want you to know. For your free consultation that will help you settle your credit card debt for a fraction of what you owe, call today. The number is 1-800-984-6953. 1-800-984-6953.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I can't begin to count how many times we've talked about the war in Iraq and the occupation over the last, what is it now, 7, going on 8 years. And I look for ways that we can continue having this in consciousness, because people are still dying, lives still being disrupted, refugees are still being created, infrastructures are being destroyed, suicide bombers continue. So even though with what we're facing economically, the war, although in its ferocious stages, has ramped down considerably, it still continues. So this is a book by an author that approaches this from, I think you will agree when we get in a conversation, that is extraordinarily unique. Who I'm going to be interviewing is Iraqi-born artist Wafa Bal, and he is right now a professor, assistant professor at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts, and he has exhibited his artwork worldwide, including Baghdad, but also the Netherlands, Ireland, Croatia, as well as the Museum of Contemporary Photography in Chicago, the Milwaukee Art Museum, and considerable number of other places as well. His book is called Shoot Iraqi: Art, Life, and Resistance Under the Sun, and it's with Carrie Leiterson. And we welcome Wafa Bal from his home in New York City. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks a lot, Peter. It is a real pleasure to be on your show.
Now, this is such an extraordinary story, and rather than getting right into what the title refers to, Shoot an Iraqi, let's just get a little of your personal history, because you were born in Iraq under Saddam Hussein, and you've been here, you've come to the United States in 1982, you're an American citizen, so you've been here a very long time, but tell us some of your childhood and where you were raised and the circumstances of how you got to the United States.
I was born in the holy city of Najaf. That's a holy Shia center for the entire world, and it's about 80 kilometers south of Baghdad, and in the 1966. And that was just a few years before the Ba'ath Revolution. And when I grew up under the regime of Saddam Hussein, basically one of the just kids who idolized the Ba'ath Party and didn't see the danger that is behind Saddam and his regime.
Hmm. Well, let me just interrupt, tell people that that you're talking about the Ba'ath Party, B-A-A-T-H, and it was Saddam Hussein's party.
Yeah.
And it was a totalitarian party in that it totalized all political thought, a lot of cultural thought, right?
Very much so, and I may add also that the regime, Saddam's regime, the Ba'ath Party, were brought to Iraq by the CIA in the early 60s, and it continued, the CIA and the United States continued to support the regime until it toppled in 2003. But going back to the childhood, I very much idolized the regime, idolized Saddam, and idolized the party as well, but growing up and see how the regime of Saddam personally dismantled any democratic infrastructure and it became a totalitarian regime that it only served one man, and any person that opposed him will be eliminated, and sometimes in a brutal way and graphic way by tying him to the nearest wall and shoot him.
Hmm.
So I early on...
Did you actually see that? Were you aware personally of how brutal and oppressive Saddam Hussein was?
As a kid, no. I mean, kid growing up, Saddam tried to replace the allegiance of a family, of the tribe, to the allegiance to the state. And he was very successful. Of kids, he take up kids and open art centers, youth centers, supply us with anything. And that was part of the plan, is to gain our trust. And in fact, it got to the point when kids start reporting their on their dad and family members that been the family members been against the state. And then in the 80s, things start changing. Before the 80s, before 1880 war with Iran, Saddam had very good control over Iraq. And in the 1980, Saddam decided to attack Iran and top the regime of Khomeini, which is it's just a very young regime, took over Iran in the revolution in 1997. And from that point, we start seeing bodies arise to Najaf, and the whole city, a lot of Shiite are buried in Najaf. And we saw the regime become more and more brutal in his effort to win the war and effort to send the young Iraqis to the front line. Then the money started rolling from the art centers, and we start opening our mind to how to the direction that Saddam was taking the country, and how families are losing just members on the basis.
Wasn't there about I think a million soldiers died during the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s? I mean, it's just a slaughter that the United States had never even faced.
That's true. I mean, 1 million people on both sides, on the Iraqi side and on the Iran side. And imagine the country was about 13 million people at the time. Imagine losing 1 million people over the period of 8 years from 1980 to 88.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a very big impact on Iraqi, and devastated Iraqis, but also brought the wars of the regime. And he starts capturing people on the street and sending them to the front line. And if people oppose that, they will be captured and executed sometime publicly.
Did you have family members that were involved in fighting?
In the front line, I had my brother for a long period of time. And I have one of my cousin that was executed for being accused of belonging to another party. And that was the turning point for me when I saw how my cousin was just unjustifiably executed. I very much woke up and I start just opposing the regime.
Let me reintroduce you as well. My guest is Wafaa Bilal. He is an Iraqi-American. He's been here since 1992, teaches art in New York City, and his book published by City Lights is Shoot Iraqi, Art, Life, and Existence Under the Gun, and we'll get to the extraordinary part that art plays in this story in just a little while. Wafaa, are you from a Shiite background?
I am a Shiite. I'm involved in the holy city of Najaf and most of the south of Iraq and parts of Baghdad are Shiite. So Saddam's in particular oppressed the Shiite in Iraq because he's from a Sunni background and Iran is mostly Shiite. So he was from the very beginning fighting the Shiite, and the Shiite never submitted to his rule, and they always fought him politically and sometimes military within inside Iraq. But he was very afraid of the alliance of the Shiite of Iran and Shiite of Iraq, and that was part of why he attack Iran right away after Khomeini took over.
Yeah, in 1979 when Khomeini took over,
exactly.
And the war began in 1980. You talk in your book, Shoot Iraqi, that you were forced to flee in a chaotic aftermath of the first Gulf War. What were the circumstances that that drove you out of the country?
Yeah, well, this brings back to us to my days in college. And what happened is when I finished high school, I applied to art school, and that was one of my dreams, a dream of a kid to finish, to go to art school to the Academy of Baghdad. And when I applied, I was rejected because of the executed cousin, and then I was sent to study geology and geography at the University of Baghdad. Through the years, about 5 years at the university, I produced an art show that was critical of the regime in a direct way or indirect way. And as a consequence, sometimes the show will be closed permanently. Sometimes the show will be confiscated. And every time I have a show, I'll be dragged to the security office at the University of Baghdad. And in 1990, when the regime invaded Kuwait, I was in the last year of college at University of Baghdad, and the regime come and asked us to volunteer to go to war. And I was one of the people who are publicly refused to do such a thing. And I know my days were numbered at that time, and I was on run. So I left Baghdad to Najaf, and from Najaf, when I got there, the war started. The United States started bombing, and Allies started bombing to free Kuwait. And that lasted about 40 days or so. But right after that, the uprising took place in Iraq against the Saddam regime.
This was in the south where the Shiites, and they initially were pretty much encouraged to do so.
Very much so.
Yeah, by George Bush the first.
That's exactly it. And when he basically forced, he gave a televised speech to the entire Iraq nation. And asking them to rebel against Saddam, and the United States will help them. And in fact, it was on the contrary. We were very surprised to see George Bush the senior helping Saddam to quell the uprising instead of helping people. So I basically was cornered because Saddam started after the uprising and people captured the city. Saddam started moving from Baghdad to all the way to Basra to capture the cities back, and he brutally bombed them with every weapon he can use under watch of the United States. And I was moving ahead of the military one city by one until I got to Kuwait. And in Kuwait, I crossed the border against the will of Kuwaitis, and I was arrested. Luckily, I was let out and stayed on the border for another 40 days. When later we were under the protection of the United States Army, and later we were transferred to refugee camps in Saudi Arabia and Spain 2 years there.
And you, in fact, I'm finding this fascinating because we just look at the bigger picture, and when we hear how the war there affects people directly, it takes on a different character to it. The book is Shooting Iraqi Art, Life, and Resistance Under the Sun. My guest is Wafa Bilal. And also reading the book along with them, Carrie Leiterson. Let's do this, because I want to hear more of this, but I also want to get people up to the subtitle of Art, Life, and Resistance Under the Gun. Now, you came here in 1992. You became an American citizen, an artist whose works have been shown all over the world. And then suddenly, you realize that in Iraq, during the 90s, there's this blockade by the United States that's causing all sorts of deaths there of Iraqi people. And then by 2002, there is the war again. The shows of war return. And yet your family was all in Iraq, right?
Very much so. I mean, I left Iraq. I was running, and the only other person, my brother, who in fact lives in Detroit right now. But the entire family left in Iraq. And one thing many people didn't know, that after the war ended in 1991, there was an embargo, a blockade against Iraq that lasted almost 10 years, and maybe more 10 years. And other consequences, 1.5 million Iraqis lost their lives because of that, and mostly kids and older. And my immediate family were impacted very strong. We lost my grandfather, my grandmother, due to very simple thing. Because they cannot afford buying simple medication. And then we lost one thing that is very important. Just our childhood memories revolve around the place we grew up, our grandfather's home. And the family were forced to sell it for nothing just so they could survive for a few months.
So you are living in the safety and comfort of the United States, and here your relatives back in the old country, as we used to call it, are suffering this great travail. What were your emotions at this period?
The emotion was very high, and I think being an artist helped me a lot to deal with the duality, just because being here, and you see there's just a great injustice being done to the Iraqi people. In fact, the embargo never affected Saddam because it made him even stronger. And in fact, some of Bush's administration, like Dick Cheney, was dealing with him directly buying the oil, or indirectly sometimes. So what I did is through the 90s, I focused my effort in exposing how the embargo hurt the Iraqi people by building shows, by going on the road for speaking tours, just to, one, to raise awareness, and I thought that is a great deal since I'm here in the United States. If anything could change, it has to come from the people, and that's why I have so much faith in the people to change the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of being against the people of the United States, I saw them as a victim as well of this political machine, the government. And I very much start connecting with people with my art show. I start connecting to people by talking to them, going from one state to another to raise awareness of the embargo. And then the war, or just the drums of a new war against Iraq, we start hearing in 2002 and early 2003, and I couldn't even believe it. We can go to another war with Iraq.
And then it occurred, and again, civilians are being killed, and your own brother was killed in Iraq by a U.S. bomb, and not by a human being, but by an unmanned predator drone. Tell us what you discovered after this terrible event occurred, that about what you saw.
Well, in 2003, I was one of a few Iraqis who opposed the war, Iraqis in the United States opposing the war, because what I saw just the people going to be affected, not Saddam's regime. And I opposed it from the very beginning, and I know there are going to be great losses and by turning Iraq to a war zone. So in 2004, unfortunately, I received the news that is one of my brothers was killed in Iraq. And at the beginning, I didn't get the details from the family how he was killed. But then I learned he was on the street when a drone plane scoped city, and then an air service missile came to where he was standing in a checkpoint and killed him instantly.
And this, you watched a TV interview and found out that a young U.S. soldier whose job it was to launch missiles into Iraq from a computer in Colorado had been the one that pushed the button. And
Very much so. So from 2004, and I have to say 2 months later, we lost my father because he was green and he couldn't handle the shock losing his son all of a sudden. So we lost him 2 months later. But I continue to think how I could connect these two zones together, the comfortable zone here, which I live in, and there the war zone, the conflict zone.
So we get actually now to the title of your book, which we've been holding people in suspense now for almost 20 minutes.
Yes.
We just have a few minutes left, so we should probably go directly to that. The book is Shoot in Iraqi, Art, Life, and Resistance under Sun Wafaa Bilal and Barry Leiterson. And you did essentially an art installation, Domestic Tension.
Yes.
And that's for the title, Shoot in Iraqi. Tell us about that.
Exactly. So in 2007, I was watching the news when I saw an interview with a soldier that's driving drone planes and dropping missiles on Iraq, in which he was asked by the reporter if she had any remorse on people's lives. She said, no, I trust the order of my superiors. And it really shocked me how we become disconnected even by targeting other people in other countries. And that's where the idea came, and the idea was I wanted to demonstrate how we are disconnected. So what I did, I moved my living space to a gallery space. I built a robot that shoot paintball at me, and I stayed in the gallery for 30 days. During that 30 days, I had people from 136 countries shooting at me with 80 million hits on the website, and 65,000 times I was shot at. I never left the gallery space, and during that time, I was constantly talking to people on a chat room, which is where they could see and talk to me 24 hours, 7 days a week for 3 days.
Let me just summarize. So you set up an installation, essentially, that people, by just a mouse click, could shoot you with a paintball. You were shot 60,000 times. Your site had millions of hits to it. And what did you think about the fact? Did it hurt when you got hit by a paintball?
It does. I mean, anybody who plays a paintball, it just really hurts. These guns are designed to shoot from 200 feet, and the gun was about 20 feet from me. It hurt a lot, but also I learned a great deal about myself, about my people, and how to deal with the losses. I denied I lost my brother, I lost my father until I was emotionally and physically exhausted in the project. And I finally admit the losses. But I think the most thing that fascinates me is just how the platform become a place for people to express their thoughts, people to connect to each other, people to talk about issues like war, and many of us here in the comfortable zone are reluctant to talk about it. And all of a sudden, you see the side that you could shoot somebody and all traffic coming in. But then you encounter this is not just a playful game. This is really human being is being shot at.
Yeah, were you shocked that you were shot at so many times with the paintballs?
Yes.
Yeah, and I see from your book, Shoot an Iraqi, that some of the what was said in the chat room was also pretty shocking, pretty racist,
very
pretty
brutal,
mean.
Very
yeah.
I mean, it's very brutal. I think that's the nature of being disconnected. Just because we part of it is we deny others because we are unaware of that culture. And I think the website demonstrated, the chat room demonstrated that very well by bringing the brutality in people to express themselves. And there are just brutal moments, but there are also wonderful moments happening there when a group of people decide to establish the virtual human shield, and for many days they start sending me by taking the gun and aiming it to the left side, so preventing people from shooting directly at me.
Oh, well, there is hope.
Of course, and I think that's what we have to believe in, because that's the only thing left to us, hope, and also we have to be determined to gain our freedom, not only freedom, but we have to be determined to ask for justice to their countries as well.
Well, you know, we're almost out of time completely, and I would leave you with the last word, Wafa Bilal. It looks like things are beginning to come to the end of this seemingly endless war and occupation that the United States launched, all on the basis of lies, of course. Is there hope for Iraq, in your estimation?
Peter, there is hope for Iraq and hope for the United States, but I'm really now, as I left the paintball project, domestic tension, was faced with a post-traumatic stress disorder, and that's what my fear is. What happened when 150,000 soldiers going to come back home? One, we have to be aware of their post-traumatic experience, but also we have to be aware that we never go to another war without knowing the fact, and we should never let any government drive us to dark places, and at the end, we and the rest of the world gonna lose.
Well, thank you so much. My guest has been Wafa Bilal. You can go to his website and see much more of all of this. W-A-F-A-A is the first name, B-I-L-A-L.com. If you miss that, you can go to City Lights. That's the publisher, citylights.com, or my website, where I'll have a link. Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. The book is Shoot an Iraqi, Art, Life, and Resistance Under the Sun. Wafa Bilal and Carrie Leiterton are the authors. Thanks so much for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Tonight Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. Home of WRIF.com. Get the latest rock news, concert listings, and we're riffing rock in the streets. Check out Motor City Deals and get stuff for half price or your 101 The Riff. Online from anywhere in the world.
Websites
worldwide. 101 WRIF at WRIF.com. Rock.
What if I told you that you could put up a brand new building and save up to half cost and up to half the time as similar conventional construction? It probably sounds too good to true. Well, just by picking up the phone, I can prove it to you. If you need retail, office, or warehouse space, or if your church or school wants to expand and save money, you need General Steel. Call today, and we'll prove to you that your new building can go up in about half time, and you'll save up to half the cost. Now, 1-800-220-4155 will help you customize your building. You choose the size. You can even add the look of brick, stucco, or stone to achieve the look you want.
If you still think this sounds too good to be true, then pick up the phone and call. The information is free when you call 1-800-220-4155. Call General Steel and find out how you can put up a brand new building in about half the time and save to half the cost of similar conventional construction. Call now. 1-800-220-4155. 1-800-220-4155.
Is your credit score holding you back? Are you paying more for everything just because you don't have perfect credit? Well, it's not your fault. Credit card companies are doing everything they can to keep you in debt and never let you escape. But I've got a system that can fix your credit score once and for all. And I'm going to send you a free tape showing you the power of my proven system today.
My credit score is now 758. My wife and I are shouting for joy right now.
Hi, I'm John Commute, creator of the Transforming Debt into Wealth system. This system doesn't just fix your credit score, it will permanently rebuild your credit status, so it can never come back to haunt you again. It works no matter how bad credit is or how much debt you have.
Our credit score was in the low 600s and now we're at 780.
You can wipe the slate clean once and for all. All right now and I'll rush you my free tape. For your free tape, call 1-800-337-1713. That's 1-800-337-1713. 1-800-337-1713.
Back to the rock.
Listen.
That rocks.
Detroit.